The House Transportation and Regional Policy Governance Policy Committee will come to order, and we do have a quorum present. Would someone like to make a motion to approve the minutes? Or I'll go with this. Representative Petersburg, would you make the motion, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the minutes of the March 1st meeting.
Thank you very much. Representative Petersburg moves approval of the minutes from the March 1st meeting. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and the minutes of March 1st, 2017 are approved. Okay, members, we are going to be taking up House File 1180 today, and that's Representative Uglum. The bill addresses distracted driving, which we know has become a very serious problem in our state and probably in our nation. And we are going to keep, we have a lot of folks who want to testify, and my goal is to hear as many folks as we can. So we're going to ask you to keep to a strict limit of 3 minutes so that we're able to really get the breadth of the sense of the public as to the issues out there and how deeply they affect people. So we have a little laminated sign. It'll say stop so that we actually can keep on track and keep the agenda moving. And we do have other items we have to take up, so we will be taking those up approximately 2:15. We want to be moving on to other things. So at this time, then, I will move the bill, House File 1180, and we're going to have it re-referred to the Public Safety Committee. So thank you for being here, Representative Uglum, and please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm here to introduce with my good friend, Representative Jim Neuberger, House File 1180, which is a hands-free cell phone distracted driving bill. This is not banning cell phones. It is a hands-free bill. It is currently in effect, and laws like this are currently in effect in over 14 states. Over 110 million people are operating with hands-free electronic devices in their cars. If you look at the bill, it's pretty simple, and I'm not going to go through that in the interest of time. I know that you've all looked at that, but I'm going to tell you a little bit about a quick synopsis about this. A lot of questions have been asked. Can I use my cell phone while driving? Yes, you can, in a voice-activated mode or other hands-free mode. People have asked, can I use a GPS with this bill? Yes, you can. It does not apply to GPS navigation systems. Can I use my phone as a GPS? Because all of our phones are smartphones and stuff, and about 8 out of 10 people now have smartphones in the United States. Can I use my phone as a GPS? The answer to that is yes, but only in a voice-activated mode or other hands-free mode. So that's important. We have provisions in the bill. If there's an emergency and you need to pick up your phone, the bill states simply that you can do that. Another question that I've been asked, are we changing the penalties? And no, we are not changing the penalties. The current fines of $50 for the first offense and $225 for the second offense remain in effect. Perhaps one of the biggest questions is, will this make the roads safer? Yes, in two ways, and I think you'll see by some of the testimony coming up after what Jim and I have to say. But enforcement right now, the current texting while driving law is unenforceable. And law enforcement, well, there's ways around it that are pretty simple, actually. So enforcement of the law for distracted driving will be much simpler. If you have a phone in your hand while you're driving in traffic, you will be subject to enforcement. Enforcement and education will be linked to improved driving behavior. It's simple. Two hands on the wheel are better than one or none. Now, why are we considering this bill today? Why now? Why in Minnesota? In Minnesota, between 2011 and 2015, you know how many crashes there were that were distracted driving? 86,000. 86,000 crashes in Minnesota between that time period. And Mr. Bob Johnson from the Minnesota Insurance Federation will testify just how much that's costing the individual here in the state for increased premiums. There's an 18% increase in distracted driving fatalities from 2014 to 2015, and Representative Neuberger has firsthand knowledge of that with his business. One in four crashes now involves distracted driving. One in five traffic fatalities involves distracted driving. It's the fourth most common contributing factor to fatalities behind speeding, impairment, and fatigue. So I will close by saying that we want this to be a work in progress. We think that by Jim and I have worked on this for a long time, in fact, virtually all summer. And I would like to turn this over to Representative Neuberger with one other thing that I forgot to say. This bill is endorsed and supported by Minnesota Safety Council. You will see the Highway Patrol here today. In your packet, you have the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, Minnesotans for Safe Driving, North Star MLS, and one that's in your packet, which may surprise you, is the Minnesota Heart Association. And if you read their letter, you'll find out that pedestrians, bikers, joggers are being killed at an alarming rate because of distracted driving. And, of course, we had something like that happen in St. Paul just a week or two ago. So I will turn it over to Representative Neuberger. He has a few things to say. And the Minnesota Safety Council.
Thank you, Representative Uglum. And Representative Neuberger, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will have my phone on so I can keep an eye on the clock so I don't get long-winded here and be respectful of your time. I'm Jim Neuberger. I'm state representative. I'm serving my third term out of Becker, Minnesota. I am, as many of you know, and I am a paramedic. Some of you don't know that. I've been one full-time at a level one trauma center for, it'll be 29 years next month. Yes, I am that old. Very busy service, and I do have firsthand knowledge, very intimate knowledge with this issue, unfortunately. But for me, this is a liberty issue. This is a very strict liberty issue for me. Our Constitution guarantees two things that we have to protect. One is life, and two is liberty. I'll get to that's my little closing tag there with the liberty part. Until last year, members and folks from the audience, this wasn't a big issue for me on my radar. I knew it was an issue, but it really didn't wasn't a big dot on the screen until two things happened. Two things happened that it put this right on the forefront for me. The first thing that happened was about a year and a half ago, I was driving home through my district with my wife, and we came across a traffic jam. The traffic was going to a crawl, one lane. I thought, oh, dang it, you know, road construction or something's going on, you know. So you get in line, and after a couple of minutes, we realized there must have been a crash up ahead of us. I could see all the lights off in the distance. So, you know, you go about 5 miles an hour, and you finally, as we're going by the crash, which was 2 miles from my house, I look out my window, and here's a minivan that's been split open like a beer can had been hit by a shotgun shell, okay? And the very first helicopter was starting to land. There were fire trucks, ambulances, lots of police. So at that point, I knew for myself, for me to stop and render assistance wasn't called for. They had more than enough resources at the time. What I come to find out later that evening, I got a call because it is my district, that a family had been broadsided by a driver who was too busy doing this on Facebook. Blew a red light at about 65 miles an hour, T-boned the van. The Maurer family lost two very precious members of their family. One was killed right at the scene. The other one died a few days later in the hospital. There were other injuries as well. I know the crews that were responded to that call. These are some very seasoned veteran paramedics, and this really rattled those people. This says that we don't rattle very easy. This one did. That was the first thing that happened. The second thing that happened is I got a statistic in December, and as Mark was saying, there's been a marked increase. The data that I have shows a 14% increase in traffic-related fatalities due to distracted driving, primarily cell phone use. Now, one of the arguments that came up is, well, what about the lipstick? What about the french fries? What about the screaming kid in the back seat, the pacifier on the floor? What about the little dog sitting on the lap? Are those things that distract us? Absolutely they are. Do I like it? No, I don't. But here's the threshold, members and members of the public. The threshold is this, is we did not have and we do not have a measurable 14% increase in fatalities due to those other things. We can take the whole menu and we can point to one thing on the menu and say, distracted driving, cell phone use, 14% increase. Now, do I like those other things? No, I don't. But that was the threshold for me, was one thing alone spiked this increase. Unfortunately, in my district, I've had four more fatalities due to this related problem in the last couple of months. Members, one person dies in Minnesota every 4 days from distracted driving, primarily from cell phone use. Every 4 days. In 4 days from now, someone's going to be dead. 4 days later, another person is going to be dead. And 4 days after that, and on and on and on. Members, I can't live with that. Not when we can do something about it. I'm very passionate about this because, as you say, I'm the very first face that most people see.
All right, so
members, I'll just close with this. We want you to be able to talk on the phone. We're not saying no to that. We're not trying to ban that. We just want you to be safe. Eyes on the road, hands on the wheel. I brought up earlier about life and liberty and that this is a liberty issue. You have no liberty if you're dead. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative. And I have some folks on the testifier list, but do you have, is this the Minnesota Highway Patrol or the
Safety Council?
Safety Council. Okay, very good.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Lisa Kahns with the Minnesota Safety Council. I am the Traffic Safety Program Manager there, and I've been asked to show how easily your phone can be made hands-free with some of the technology that's available, and it's price-effective. The one technology that I have here is just the earbuds that actually came with my phone. If you put one earbud, not two, because two is not legal in the state of Minnesota. So if you put one earbud into your phone or into your ear, and then you just push your Siri, I have an iPhone, and say, Siri, call home. I am now connected. My phone is dialing home. I'm hands-free. And it's that simple to be hands-free in a hands-free mode, just with the earbuds that came with your phone. We did some searching around and some investigating on other prices. If you don't have that capability and you have an older model vehicle to go hands-free, you can use an aux cable. This was a dollar at the dollar store, and you can plug it into your phone, plug it into your aux cable device within your phone and read the instructions and hit the aux on your vehicle. There's instructions on the internet all over that show how to do that. It's pretty simple. It does not give you the availability to utilize your phone and manipulate your phone. It gives you the ability to be hands-free and listen to that phone call over the phone through your radio system in your car. This we picked up just at the local store, $20. Again, it's just that hands-free headset. Goes right onto your ear, plugs into your phone, and you're now hands-free with that one-touch dialing mechanism. So in terms of different uses and different technology pieces, affordable technology to make yourself in your vehicle hands-free, it's easy to do and quite affordable. Thank you.
Very good. Well, why don't we bring up the rest of your testifiers then, Representative?
Madam Chair, I think next we have we have Colonel.
Colonel Langer.
Colonel Langer from the Minnesota Highway Patrol.
Okay, and next I would have Bob Johnson from the Minnesota Insurance Federation. Okay. Yes, good afternoon, Colonel.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm here representing the State Patrol. For the record, my name is Matt Langer. I serve as the Chief of the State Patrol. And I'm here to testify in support of this bill on behalf of the State Patrol, on behalf of the Department of Public Safety, and on behalf of drivers everywhere. And I sort of thought the best way to articulate this was not to maybe go through the nuances of the law or always what we see when we're behind the wheel as troopers trying to enforce our laws, but 3 years ago this summer, a woman named Andrea Bovey in southwest Minnesota on a perfect summer day picked her kids up and put them in a bicycle trailer and headed out for a bike ride, as she often did. It happened to be one of her two daughters' very first bike ride in that trailer behind the bike, so she did what any mom would do, what I would do as a father. She took a picture before they left. A little bit down the road, she encountered a man named Chris Weber who was driving a vehicle doing online banking on a flip phone. He wasn't texting. He wasn't surfing the Internet. He was going through prompts, doing some online banking, looking at his phone. He never saw Andrea, never saw the bike trailer, and the right mirror of that straight truck clipped the trailer and clipped Andrea, and she was killed very close to her home, left both kids injured severely and both kids motherless now. I've had the honor of meeting her husband, Matt Bovey, and the Department of Public Safety has put together a video called Shattered Dreams. If you Google that, you'll find it on the DPS YouTube webpage, and that provides a stellar example of exactly what this bill is aiming to prevent. Put your phone down, pay attention to driving, and so I feel in some ways I'm here testifying on behalf and speaking for Andrea, who can't be here to speak on behalf of her two kids who now don't have a mom, and Matt, who no longer has a husband. This bill will make it easier for law enforcement to enforce the texting while driving law. As I've testified in other committees, the State Patrol does not receive fine revenues from any citations issued. And to be honest, as I told Representative Uglem, I'd be thrilled if we didn't issue these tickets, because that would tell me that people are just paying attention to driving. So although it would make it easier to enforce the law, sitting here as the chief of the State Patrol, I have no interest in issuing additional citations, but I think this would be a wonderful opportunity for Minnesotans to change their behaviors and to make our roads safer by simply paying attention.
Well, Colonel, could we ask about the data? I mean, does the State Patrol gather causation data on accidents? And, I believe you, but it would be great to know really sort of when you say distracted driving, what are we looking at?
Madam Chair, great question, and members of the committee. The Office of Traffic Safety does publish crash facts on an annual basis, and every data element that is in the Minnesota crash report is then put into that comprehensive report. And so we'd be happy to provide any data that you'd like. The newest version of the crash report does a better job at capturing the reason for distraction, but certainly distracted driving is a cause for concern for us, and everyone we encounter seems to have the exact same concern.
Very good. Thank you, Colonel Langer. Who do you have up next then? Oh, we have questions? All right. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've been concerned about distracting driving for quite a few years now, and it seems like when anybody comes to you with an issue, the use of cell phones is the next thing that they talk about. I have a question. If you were going to stop somebody, it's just the fact that you would have to see that they are holding the cell phone in their hand. Is that what this bill means?
Colonel Langer.
Madam Chair, Representative Mason, that's correct. So this bill, in plain language or common sense, says you can talk on the phone, you just can't be holding the phone or using the phone to have that conversation. So if this bill were to pass and law enforcement saw someone driving down the road with their phone like this, that would be reason to stop that vehicle and take enforcement action in the form of a citation or a warning for that violation.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chief Langer, kind of Representative Mason talked about the enforcement. That was my question. How does this bill change the enforcement? You'd mentioned having two hands or your phone up to your ear. Is it state law that you have to have two hands on the steering wheel?
Langer.
Madam Chair, Mr. Representative, no, it's not. And so one of the common problems that we have with the current law, it's common sense it shouldn't text while driving. Texting while driving is illegal in Minnesota. Looking at my phone to dial a phone number is not illegal in Minnesota. So the challenge sometimes for law enforcement is when we see someone who's driving down the road for an extended period of time, we look over, as others do, and see them on their phone manipulating it. We could assume that they were texting, we could stop that vehicle, and we encounter situations where people say, I was texting, I shouldn't have been doing it, I'm sorry. we encounter situations where people say, I wasn't texting, I was actually trying to dial a phone, I was looking for directions, I was doing anything you can imagine on a phone. It doesn't matter if you're texting or looking for a phone number. If you're looking at your phone, you're not watching what you're doing behind the wheel. So the actual driving behavior and the danger to the rest of us is the same, whether you're texting or doing anything else. So I think one of the advantages of this law as it pertains to traffic safety is that it simply says put the phone down, pay attention to your driving.
Madam Chair?
Okay.
Follow up.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to clarify, the previous testifier had the earbuds or the auxiliary line to your car speakers. Would it be against the law, according to this bill, if you're holding the phone and talking into it, not up to your ear, but just simply to utilize the phone better so you're having the conversation? Does this bill prohibit that? And how is it easier to enforce?
Colonel Langer.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think I understand your question. The bill is meant to be hands-free talking, so if you're holding the phone, that defeats the purpose of the bill. We don't want you to be holding anything while you're behind the wheel, whether I don't want to go on beyond distracted driving with cell phone use, but the bill is hands-free, and it's meant to be that way, and maybe Representative Uglem would like to clarify it. He's probably considered that question already.
Representative Uglem, do you have some comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Kosnick. Yes, the bill is hands-free. This, if you've ever driven in Chicago or Illinois or whatever, if you have your cell phone in your hand, that is a violation also in the other 14 states with 110 million population. The demonstration that we saw from the Minnesota Safety Council shows you that you can operate hands-free with those very inexpensive devices and still receive phone calls or make phone calls.
Madam Chair?
Representative Kosnick.
I appreciate the clarification that, you know, the first testifier said that you know, and she even held the phone up, your wires aren't necessarily long enough all the time. So I guess it might be an individual responsibility to get a long enough wire, but I don't see where it says in the bill that you can't touch your cell phone. It says if you have it on your hands-free mode, you should be able to use the cell phone. So I'm having a little problem with the language in terms of you put it in a hands-free mode. Maybe you use the auxiliary line or the earbuds, and it only can be one earbud, not two. But if it's in a hands-free mode and it's not against the law to hold your phone, that's where I need a little clarification in the language, I think.
Representative Uglem.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, I think staff, Matt Burris, could address that a little bit because we do talk in the bill about one-touch functionality.
Mr. Burris, please.
Madam Chair and members, I would read the language as a broad-based prohibition that then establishes some exceptions. So the prohibition is on use of a cellular phone with a couple of examples given on that prohibition as examples, initiating a cellular phone call and talking or listening on the phone. I would take that to include holding on to a phone, whether it's held up to one's ear or just held at a distance. And then among the exceptions is making a cellular phone call through the use of one-touch functionality. So that would be one of the exceptions where a single touch to initiate the call would be permitted, but otherwise holding the phone I wouldn't take as being permissible under the bill language.
And so, Representative, I think, though, there are some questions like this, sort of the intricacies of what is meant and, you know, certain devices and so on, or are they going to be permissible and so on. And maybe we can get some clarification, but I'd like to proceed and pick up some other questions. So, Representative Barr?
Representative Kosnick answered the question.
Okay. Okay, Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe this question would be for the Colonel. I was trying to look at the underlying statute because I can't remember when we passed the texting provision if it's a primary offense, if you can be stopped just for that.
Colonel Langer.
Madam Chair, Representative, it is a primary offense.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so I thank you for your testimony, and we have next Bob Johnson. Please come up, sir, and welcome.
Madam Chair, committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. And my members write a majority of the private passenger personal auto insurance sold in the state and that your constituents all buy. We're here to strongly support this bill, and as Representative Uglem indicated, I'm going to talk just for a minute or two about the economics of distracted driving, and the economics of distracted driving is increased auto insurance premiums in the state and around the country. You know, there were two editorials, articles recently, 2 days ago, a lead editorial in the USA Today that was entitled Texting While Driving Hurts Everyone. And it talked about not only the human cost, but the economic cost of it. The Wall Street Journal, just a few days earlier, did a pretty extensive story entitled Smartphone Addicts Behind the Wheel Drive Car Insurance Rates Higher. Insurers increasingly blame distracted drivers as costs related to crashes outpace premiums. And that's a pretty important words that, and this is an article that talks to the nation's leading top executives of the auto insurers that many of you buy from that sell around the country. And they're sounding an alarm to their customers and to this country of this impact of distracted driving specifically on auto insurance premiums in this country. And you've heard the statistics about the percentage and the amount of crashes. Well, all that translates, those dollars, into the premiums that we all pay. One of the nation's leading auto insurers executive has in that article termed this is an epidemic issue. And it's important to highlight those words because those words aren't used that often in terms of what auto insurers is paying for in terms of crashes and injuries. But some of the numbers, just quickly, is that from 2011, and some of this is countrywide, so it's a little bit mixed countrywide and statewide, but the countrywide increases of the average annual car insurance premium is 16% since 2011. If you looked at the 5 years before that, premiums, that average was flat, if not slightly decreasing. And so in a time where we have newer, safer vehicles and the technologies and cars, and I think the predictions and the estimates were that we're going to be seeing more benefits in terms of decreased costs. And the point is that the statistics are not showing that. What we're seeing is those trends and those numbers going up significantly. And so from the industry's perspective, a couple of other comments, that in Minnesota we have a $3.5 billion auto insurance market, so that's what consumers collectively pay. Each 1% increase in cost is about $35 million. To just put some numbers now, I don't have percentages here. I don't have numbers specifically today because we don't break down premium filings to identify just distracted driving. I think as we go forward, we're going to see the industry, because we're the keeper of the statistics and the data, and so I think we'll see more specific breakouts that identify it. But the point is, we know by the statistics you've heard these increase in crashes is just it's exceeding what the industry's estimates are. And again, we predict based on historical past what's going to happen in the future. And if those predictions are wrong, and that's what we're seeing, is that the trends are exceeding those predictions, that the numbers are going to continue. And as in, last 2 points, Madam Chair, is that what insurers are seeing is an increasing number of crashes with no skid marks. So no skid marks tells you something importantly, that things are happening and people are not aware of it at all, and that we're confident, and I'm confident in saying that the national statistics are significantly underreporting. There's a lag between what insurers are seeing and what law enforcement and what the statistics being reported are showing. So we are confident, Madam Chair and committee members, that there is a lot more to this even than what you've heard so far and what we have as a state and the public safety statistics. So from the auto insurer's perspective, Madam Chair, we just urge your support for this bill, moving it forward. It's important we deal with this, and we can deal with it and help impact that curve of what the costs and the premiums for Minnesota drivers are experiencing. So,
Mr. Johnson,
you.
If I could just ask, do you keep any data as to the ages of who are the operators of the vehicle that's caused the accident, and do we know if this is you know, significantly a problem with, say, folks under 25, or do we have any data at all on that?
Madam Chair, I think the previous witness that the public safety's crash facts It's actually a pretty comprehensive database, so that would be, at least for, in terms of all the police reports and statistics, I mean, we clearly know as an industry the categories of buyers and, you know, the ages, because we have to know that in terms of price of the product. So there is data that shows, I think, what we're so the answer is that there. Yes, I don't have it here today, but I'll be part of that effort to supply you and the committee members with whatever statistic we have to help answer that question.
Great. Thank you very much. Representative Bernardi, question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I would like to ask our testifier, Mr. Johnson, I just want to make sure I got this right. What time frame did you say that these were, just briefly, what time frame did this trend start going up in the cost of insurance?
Representative, it was in 2010. So the preceding 6 years, if you charted, it was literally, there was this slight downward movement. Now, this is countrywide, and Minnesota tracked that. Country down, 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 kind of flattened, and then it's been a constant increase since 2010. And this isn't the only factor.
Madam Chair, the reason why I asked that question is because Towards Zero Death has been seeing a downward trend over the years, and then all of a sudden last year it really spiked. And so I'm trying to get down to that. Was it the speed limit increases in Minnesota? Is it distracted driving? I'm trying to get those answers because Representative Neuberger, he talked about four deaths, you know, one death every 4 days. And I've been actually care about this topic. I've been tracking, my intern has been tracking the deaths and serious injuries in Minnesota, and that's standing true today. So it's a huge issue, and we've got to get down to the bottom of this and help prevent these deaths.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. So I have on the list, we have Representative Kosnick. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Johnson, I had a question kind of directed towards you, if you wouldn't mind. Madam Chair.
Representative Kosnick.
The current text messaging ban that is in law, how has that affected your insurance claims?
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, Madam Chair. I think all I can tell you is that the statistics, the crash facts in terms of the number of fatalities or serious injuries, all of those are what translate into the premiums. So I don't know that there is a breakout that I wouldn't have today that would identify how that has impacted those numbers.
Okay.
So I simply don't have that. But again, we're the deliverer of the message to your consumers about what's the cost of those collective, you know, fatalities and serious injuries. All that works its way down to the premiums that we're paying in the state. So I don't have that breakout that could answer that.
All right. Thank you. Representative Kosnick.
Mr. Johnson, it's just kind of a follow-up to that. you know, and it's you know, I think this is an important topic, and we're moving in the right direction. I'm just want to make sure that we have a bill that achieves the author's intent. Do you, Mr. Johnson, think that, you know, we currently have distracted driving laws in the statute that this is going to be in. Would there be a deterrent effect to people if the increase of the fine, because we're not touching that or increasing the fine at all, and so I'm not sure the effectiveness of what we're trying to do.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, is that a question? So if
there was an increase in the fines, would that have a more impactful effect of reducing cell use during driving?
Yeah, Madam Chair,
Mr.
Representative. I think from our perspective, I actually would look to law enforcement as having a better opinion on what the higher fine, I think, as I look at it, and I think the effort here is not to deal with that part of it. And I respect from law enforcement's perspective that the current texting while driving ban is almost impossible to enforce, just as it's been just described to you better than I can do. So, I would have a personal opinion. I don't have an industry opinion on increasing the fine. I think this is an important step and will be helpful with dealing with that increase that we're experiencing.
Thank you.
Okay. Great. So we have on the list a number of folks who wish to testify, and I have Greg and Sylvie Tikalski, Dan Dorman, Greg and Amy LaValle. How about if we start with those three individuals? Welcome to the committee, sir. And
thank you. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you. My name is Greg Tikalski, and I guess I'll wait for my daughter, Sylvia, as well. Oh. If you want. I'm not sure how we want. Okay. On October 28, 2015, my dad, Joe Tikalski, received a life sentence while getting his morning newspaper. As Mr. Johnson mentioned, he was one of those individuals who was killed without any skid marks left. The driver was completely unaware of the fact that she had struck something. One of the ironies of the tragedy with Dad is that he worked for nearly 50 years as a school bus driver and delivered nearly 100 children to and from school safely every day. He did that job with great pride and diligence. Since Dad's tragic death, my family has become advocates for safe driving. Our roadways are filled with drivers who make the selfish choice of putting other tasks in front of the number one task of driving the vehicle. I'm not alone in my outrage. Mr. Johnson had mentioned an epidemic. Federal safety officials call distracted driving a serious epidemic. If we had a serious medical health concern deemed an epidemic, resources would be appropriated to eradicate or at the very least prevent the epidemic from spreading. We have an epidemic. I'm not seeing that treatment regarding texting and driving. I see an unchecked epidemic. Texting and driving is playing Russian roulette with a 4,000-pound killing machine. I read that the State Patrol and MnDOT are teaming up to crack down on cheaters in the fast lane. They allocated $2.6 million and dedicated six officers to enforce the rules of the Diamond Lane. That problem's annoying. This one's deadly. Violators of the Diamond Lane pay $100 to $200, yet the first offense for texting is $50. Distracted driving is not a temporary concern. As the number of apps on our cell phone increase, the addiction to reach for the phone is only going to become greater. I teach high school at New Prague. At the beginning of each class period, I have to tell my students, time to put away your electronic pacifiers. This generation of kids is inseparable from their phone. Today, we're at a crossroad. We have an opportunity to begin to make Minnesota roads safer for all of us. One argument against the bill is that it won't reduce crashes. Our legislator is convinced it will. At least it did in the case of commercial vehicles. In January 2012, the Minnesota State Legislature passed a law that made it illegal for commercial vehicle drivers to use handheld mobile phone while operating the vehicle. Their logic came from research commissioned by the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. The research showed that the odds of being involved in a safety-critical event are six times greater for drivers who engage in dialing a mobile phone while driver than for drivers who are not. Dialing drivers took their eyes off the road for an average of 3.8 seconds. At 55, that equates to traveling 306 feet without looking at the road. Why would the research used to pass the law requiring CMVs not be used to pass the current proposal? I can tell you, it doesn't take a big truck to kill a pedestrian. I've heard requiring hands phone use is discriminatory against those who don't have a vehicle with Bluetooth. I would argue it's discriminatory to impose an unexpected funeral expense on an innocent victim's family. The average funeral cost is about $7,000, and that expense is incurred without warning. The cost to make a cell phone Bluetooth compatible is about $50. That expense I can plan for. And I conclude, although I believe a better deterrent to curb this dangerous behavior is implementing a more serious penalty when it results in injury or death, that's the subject of another hearing. This bill is a start. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tikalski. And who is up next, please?
Hi, I'm Sylvie Tikalski, and my grandpa was killed by a distracted driver. A mom trying to help her kid cost my grandpa his life. A moment to reach for a phone and send a text message took away years of family memories. The police report stated, I looked away for a minute. I was running late for work. I was sending a text to my daughter to tell her how to change a passcode on her phone when I saw a yellow blur. That blur was my grandpa in his yellow reflective bus driving jacket while he was getting his mail. The driver is a mom who loves her kids like my parents love us. She didn't mean to kill grandpa, but she did. There has to be a consequence like there is for drunk driving, or this will continue to happen. My grandpa's death has impacted me greatly. Since the accident, I now sleep with a nightlight on, and I struggle with separation anxiety, especially with my parents. I'm so afraid something will happen to them when they leave. I was always excited for college, but I'm reluctant to graduate next year and go to college because I don't want to be away from home. It was especially hard the first spring and summer. It's hard not seeing Grandpa in his garden that he loves so much, not seeing Grandpa walk in the cornfields or getting the tractors ready. My grandpa isn't able to watch his grandkids compete in track, cross country, soccer, wrestling, dance competitions, swim meets, and theater. He won't be able to see me on my graduation day, and if I were blessed, watch me walk down the aisle on my wedding day. We are blessed to live next to Grandma and Grandpa, but that is also a curse since we have to drive by the spot where he laid in the ditch several times a day. We don't know how long he would have lived, but the driver made that decision by ending his life that day, simply by taking time to text her child, not watching the road. As a new licensed driver, I have learned a lot. The day before I took my license test, it was very emotional for me because I was taking a big step in my life. The day I got my license, I made a promise. I made a promise not to ever text and drive. I'm not only doing this for myself, not only to possibly save others' lives, but I'm doing this for my grandpa. I know he would be very proud of me. It really hurts me when I think of others killed because of texting or distracted driving, because I know how their family feels. Millions of people text, Snapchat, tweet, Facebook, check emails, message, etc. every day while they are driving. I see my classmates and others do it all the time. I see my age group posting videos of them driving while the scenery is flying by and their hands aren't even on the wheels. This is normal for my generation to have their phones in their hands, and it will only get worse. They know exactly what they are doing, and they know it's against the law, but they do it anyway. Why would they stop texting if the penalty isn't stiff and there isn't a hands-free law? If I knew that the punishment would be extremely harsh, I wouldn't dare touch my phone. How many crashes, deaths will it take until we take this crime seriously? Please help me, help us to stop this epidemic. 3 months after Grandpa was killed, I was diagnosed with an inoperable brain tumor. I understand it is no one's fault. It could not have been prevented. Things happen like that in life. When Grandpa was killed, that could not have been prevented. Texting is not an accident, it is a choice. Kids my age are so attached to their phones, myself included, but I made the promise not to ever text while operating a vehicle because driving is your responsibility, not texting. We have to realize that we live in a society that is technology-oriented, and we need to get the phones out of our hands. According to a 2010 survey done by the Kaiser Family Foundation, 31% of kids aged 8 to 10 have cell phones. That was 2010. The New York Times said that second graders as young as 7 are getting cell phones. If kids are growing up with cell phones, they're not only going to be addicted, but will grow up being attached and won't want to put driving first. It will be a habit to always have their phone with them, and for some, it already is. Kids are owning phones now at an even younger age than when I did, and it will be much more difficult for them to break that habit of being in a car and not on the phone. We have to realize that not many people are putting driving first and making driving a priority. People are only going to get worse on the roads in the future. I hope I live long enough to see a change in texting laws and hope to see people who text and drive held accountable and given the maximum punishment to prevent others from making the same deadly choice. Please pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your important testimony. So we'll move on now to Greg and Amy LaValle. Welcome to the committee. And please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representatives. My name is Greg LaValle. This is my wife, Amy. We're from Otsego, Minnesota. We're here today to support House File 1180. This is my beautiful son, Philip. I want to introduce you to him and tell you a little bit about him and his story. Philip was a perfect student, always on the A Honor Roll. He was a record-setting runner at Monticello High School and went on to run Division I at South Dakota State University. But he was more than an athlete and scholar. He was also just a friendly and fun person. Actually, one of my favorite stories actually came from our mailman. Philip would be out running every day, and apparently he would actually smile and wave at the mailman every day. And the mailman came to our door not long after Phil was killed and told us that story and what a difference it made in his day because Philip would do that. That's the kind of the person he was. He always had a smile or a joke to make your day. The summer Philip was killed, he was working full-time and running nearly 50 miles per week. I actually have the GPS watch data from his runs and spent many hours looking through them, looking at his pace and where he ran. This is going to be a little bragging, I'm sorry. One of my favorites was on July 28th. He ran 13 miles, averaging 6 minutes and 15 seconds per mile. On August 8th, 2013, he took off for his run at 11:30 a.m. He ran his first mile at 7:11, not bad considering the first half mile was uphill. His second mile was 6:43, third was 6:37, fourth was 6:36, and fifth was 6:18. Philip did not get to finish his sixth mile. He was clocking about 6:24 pace down a straight, flat road on a sunny summer day. Just after noon, he was struck in the back by a distracted driver. His shoes ended up in the middle of the road. His brains were spattered on a telephone pole. His body was discarded in the stranger's front yard. This is the reality we learned from reading the police report. I can't tell you how many times I've opened the GPS file for this run. The driver was 67 years old, by the way. 67. I'm an engineer, and I like data. I like graphs. But the data from the GPS file doesn't help me. Can't tell me what Phil was thinking about in those final moments. Can't tell me if he felt anything or if he even knew what happened. These questions still haunt me. I don't know what the past 3.5 years might have held for him. Would he have become an engineer as he was studying? Would he have met a girl? He used to joke with Amy and I and tell us to buy tickets to Rio. He dreamt of running in the Olympics. We'll never know if he had the talent to go that far. We'll never know the answers to any of those questions. What a terrible loss that Philip put so much into his life and was unable to fulfill his dreams. It was a terrible loss that his brothers, Andrew and Marcus, won't have their older brother to guide them or stand at their side at their weddings. It was also a terrible loss that Amy and I would never be able to meet his wife or hold his babies or watch him become a father. It simply breaks our hearts. I support this legislation because I don't want more parents to go through what we are going through. More important, I don't want other young people to lose their lives. It's so senseless. I don't think the legislation goes far enough, and I do think they should increase the fines. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Mr. LaValle. And next up we have John Dudley, and then after that, Craig and Peggy Riggs. Welcome to the committee, sir. Appreciate you being here. Please give us your name for the record.
My name is John Dudley. Thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to be here and committee members. This is my son, Andrew. This is the picture that was shown on the news for the 3 days after his accident. He was going east. He was coming out of a Wednesday youth group at Cross of Glory Church at Shady Oak Road and Excelsior Boulevard. There was a lady going east on Excelsior Boulevard, turning right to go south to go to Wooddale Church to pick up her kids. She's talking on her cell phone. She never saw him. I've had a commercial driver's license since 1976. And since then, the increased traffic and the aggressiveness of traffic in the Twin Cities has exponentially grown. And with the advent of this thing, it's exploded even more. It's become a more of a selfish entitlement mentality that I bought this cell phone, I pay for the airtime, you can't tell me what I can't do with it. And I've got confused. Anyway, Andrew was, you know, is dead before we got there. And I have PowerPoint presentation that I've used, you know, spoken several times with the impact groups at Minnesotans for Safe Driving. And There's more I could say, but I just want to end up shortly by saying, how many here have children? Just raise your hand real quick. Grandchildren? I want to end my my comments here with what I say at that my PowerPoint presentation. But before I go, and during that PowerPoint presentation, I talk about the article that I wrote for the St. Louis Park Sun-Sailor, and the title of it is called Driving is a Full-Time Job. And in that article, I talk about the Smith system, which is the points of that is leave yourself an out, aim high, meaning look way down the road, make sure they see you, keep your eyes moving, you know, all over the place, and get the big picture. And this is what I learned while the last time I went through driver training for driving school bus, and it's really helped me a lot to some extent, and I think it's very beneficial for what we, you know, all learned from when we first obtained a driver's license. And it's kind of scary from what I see as a professional driver driving school bus in between real jobs and manufacturing. I've worked retail and drove in school bus. So with the advent of your answers to raising your hand to your kids, I urge you to go home, hug your kids, grandkids, often, and tell them how much you love them, because I can't do that anymore with my hand. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, sir. And welcome to the committee, and please give us your name for the record.
Madam Chair, representatives, my name is Peggy Riggs. I want to thank you for allowing me to speak before you on one of the most important issues facing us today, and that is driving while being distracted. I sit before you a very proud mother of three. Like all mothers and fathers, we have hopes and dreams for our children, what they will become, what their life's goals will be, where their future will take them. And I know that my three boys had high hopes and many dreams for themselves. What I never dreamt or could imagine is that one of them would become a statistic. On August 13th, 2013, my youngest son, David, at the age of 20, became one of the growing statistics of people losing their lives to distracted drivers. David was waiting to turn into our driveway on his motor scooter on a beautiful, clear summer night. He was struck from behind by an 18-year-old that was texting and driving. I was inside our home hearing what had just taken place. My husband was the second one on the scene, coming down the street, returning from work. Imagine if you can, seeing your child lying in the street right outside your home, motionless, clinging for life. 4 days later, David was removed from life support. Our dreams, his dreams were shattered, all because a young man chose to text and drive. Before the crash, David was fulfilling his dreams of going to college, having a girlfriend that he had met when he was a freshman in high school, his dreams of marrying her and planning a future. David had many friends. He had a job he loved. He had a huge family he loved. And we loved him back more than I can express today. This has been devastating to our family and to our community. David had his whole life ahead of him. We will not be able to see the kind of husband he would have been, or to see the kind of father he would have been. We are unable to see the kind of uncle he would have been to his new niece, Eve. We can only imagine. And all of this could have been prevented if drivers would put their phones away while driving. We need to do whatever we can to prevent these kinds of crashes so other families won't have to suffer the pain we now live with each and every day. We are asking you to give this bill your full support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are you interested in testifying too, Mr. Ricks?
Madam Chair and Representatives, I'm David Stad. So my family, along with many members in the community, have been educating the dangers of distracted driving, specifically the use of the cell phone in the car, for the past 3 years. As you can see by the people in this room, telling our stories don't seem to be dropping the statistics. Education is critical to changing the culture, but we also need the help of law enforcement for compliance, especially being it's a life safety issue. The law would give police additional tools to help monitor and stop this deadly behavior. If this behavior only affected the driver, it would be one thing, but it's not. Drivers are putting others at risk. I understand that tragedies do happen for a lot of different reasons, but tragedies like these could be prevented. And the last thing I'd like to conclude is I ride the bus now because I don't really care to be on the road in the morning driving to Minneapolis. And what I would like to share with this group, if anybody's ever ridden the bus, I can see everything that goes on in a car. And I'm telling you, be afraid. Because I can't count on both my hands how much distraction I see, and it's almost 90% phone usage. I want to thank you for your time, and please support this bill.
Thank you very much to both of you. Next we have Kathy Kostoritz. And after that, Lori Hevier.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Welcome to committee.
Members of the committee. My name is Kathy Kostoritz, and I want to start by thanking you for allowing us to be here today. I want to thank you, too, for even hearing this bill, for allowing us to speak in support of its passage. David Riggs was my nephew, and the hardest part of that statement is to have to use the word was. David was bigger than life, his entire life. He had parents, brothers, a girlfriend of 6 years who was very likely to be his wife someday, cousins, aunts, and uncles, and coworkers and friends who numbered into the hundreds, possibly thousands, as we learned over the course of the days following the crash. I had the absolute great fortune of being part of David's life from the day he came into this world until the day he left. There is absolutely nothing I can tell you about David that will help you really understand what a great kid he was and what he meant to so many others. What I really hope to convey today is that, sadly, David's story and the loss of David does not just affect us or a few people. It truly affects the world. And sadly, David's story is becoming less and less unique in Minnesota every day. What I also hope to convey to you is that David's story and that of my family and other families here today may well someday be your very own story and that of someone close to you. If in August of 2013 hands-free legislation was in place in Minnesota, there is a really good chance my nephew David would still be alive today. The young man who killed David had just finished sending his last of several texts as he drove down Helmo Avenue in Oakdale 5 days after Philip LaValle was killed. He was fumbling around with his phone after finishing his text, and he was putting it in his cup holder when he crashed into David. At the scene of the crash, the young man kept crying and screaming over and over, I'm sorry, I wasn't paying attention. That young man was supposed to go to college the week that David was going back to school. He has dropped out of school, and we have absolutely no idea what he's going to do with his life, but in my opinion, his life is over as well. According to the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, this type of distraction played a role in the 21% climb in distracted driving-related fatalities in 2015 from the previous year. And traffic fatalities reached 411 last year in Minnesota, compared to 361 in 2014. And I have that same statistic from the Department of Public Safety, that's a 14% increase. Last year, 181,663 people were involved in some type of crash, the equivalent of the populations of Duluth and Plymouth combined. Conversely, in 2012, the California Office of Traffic Safety announced that deaths due to handheld cell phone use by drivers had dropped by 47%, while overall traffic deaths declined by only 22% since California enacted their ban on handheld cell phone use while driving cars in July of 2008. This data proves in my mind without a doubt that when people are driving with both hands on the wheel instead of on their phone, fewer people die. I don't want to quote more statistics because I'm certain you're familiar with them as you have worked to address this issue. That said, the night that David was killed, his brother Matthew was serving his second tour of duty in Afghanistan. Matthew made it safely home from a war zone, and David couldn't make it into the driveway without being killed. In addition to stressing the point that David's story could very well be all of our stories someday, if we don't do something soon to fix this problem of distracted driving and handheld mobile devices, I want to ask you to consider this problem isn't just affecting us, the people in this room, or the 411 who died on Minnesota roads in 2016. It affects everyone who knew those 411 people, their families, their coworkers, their communities. I've asked Isaac, I believe is your name, to pass a picture around. And what it is, it's a picture that someone took outside my sister Peggy and Craig's, my brother-in-law Craig's home the night before David's funeral, an impromptu vigil of community members that formed around the house that night, totally unbeknownst to us while we were in the house preparing for the funeral. It's difficult to know how many people were there, but the crowd caused such an effect that the Oakdale police were called to their home for the second time in a week to close down Helmo Avenue and many of the side streets connecting to Helmo Avenue. A co-worker of my sister Peggy's approached her just a week ago and told her and formally introduced herself. She had known of Peggy but didn't know her personally. She said that to this day, the community of Oakdale is still mourning David's death. We were told 750 people attended David's funeral. They are also affected by David's death, as were the many people they are connected to, their spouses, their children, their friends. This is a Minnesota issue. We can't afford to continue to lose good people, young and old, due to preventable crashes. As representatives of all of us in Minnesota's communities, you have an incredible opportunity to pass life-saving legislation in this hands-free bill, and I cannot implore you enough to please vote yes. And thank you so much for your consideration.
And thank you very much, too. Lori Hevier. And Rhonda Maurer would be next.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Thank you for being here. Please give us your name for the record.
I'm sorry. My name is Lori Hevier. Thank you for letting me speak this afternoon. I'd like to share with you what happened to my mom, Julie Davis. She was also known as Dewbug by her brothers and sisters and her parents. She went to go hiking with her best friend on a beautiful April afternoon. And at that same time, a young woman was driving, heading to college. She hit and killed my mom. My mom's best friend said they were talking away. 1 second she was there, the next she was gone. My mom lived a very fulfilling life on a small hobby farm. She was a lay minister. She was a loving daughter, a big sister, dedicated friend, proud mother, and one incredible grandmother. According to the crash report and several witnesses, the driver was speeding approximately 70 miles per hour in a 55-mile-an-hour zone. Seen swerving between the fog line and the center lane before hitting my mom. There wasn't any attempt to brake. As you've heard, there were no skid marks. She hit my mom at full speed. It's estimated that she could not have been looking at the road for 8.75 seconds not to see two adult women. Think about that, 8.75 seconds. It was determined that the driver had divided attention because there were no other factors such as weather, road conditions, or vehicle malfunctions that could have contributed to this crash. To me, this wasn't a fluke accident. It was a preventable crash. This was a hike that my mom took on a regular basis. And while this occurrence actually happened in Wisconsin, the research that you've heard today, this is an epidemic that's all over our nation. And I'd love to see Minnesota take that step forward. My husband has prevented being T-boned several times because he is acutely aware of what's going on around him. I can't tell you how many times he's told me that he prevented a crash because he didn't go on a green light. Someone blew through a red light and you could see them on their phone. I don't think it would be fair if that happened to me again, but it wasn't fair the first time either. It's been several years for my family, and I can tell you it doesn't get easier. And since then, my heart breaks for all these people that I've met since then. And I'm asking you, please, to take this into consideration and pass this bill. It's time for a change. Thank you.
We appreciate your testimony. And do we have Rhonda Maurer then?
Yes.
Okay, welcome to the committee. Please give us your name and proceed.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Rhonda Maurer. On the evening of July 21st, 2015, as Chuck was trying to cross Highway 10 on his way home from the library with three girls in his car, he had a green light and he went through the intersection. He was T-boned by a 17-year-old girl messaging on Facebook while driving a Ford F-150 extended cab at 65 miles an hour. I often thought in my head, why didn't he wait? Did he not see the truck barreling down the road? It wasn't until I read the police report that I found out Chuck had the green light, and he was not the first vehicle to enter the intersection. He was the second. Chuck died that night in flight to the hospital with injuries described to me by a friend. She told me that it was basically somebody taking a bat to his insides and swinging as hard as they could several times. There wasn't an organ in his body that wasn't damaged. 10 days after the crash and 4 days after laying Chuck to rest, my cousin, who was 10, could not make the turn towards recovery that we needed her to make. Her mother had to make a decision no mother deserves to make. Cassie was taken off life support, and her organs were donated so others could live. Cassie would have wanted it that way. She was a very giving child. She learned that from Chuck. I can't describe in words the pain my family has had to endure. It was one crash. Six lives forever changed, two lost. It was a crash that could have been prevented in so many different ways. Not only was the driver messaging on Facebook, she did not have a driver's license, she did not have a permit to be behind the wheel, and there were no skid marks. The bill we are discussing is long overdue in Minnesota. I read about crashes weekly that involve someone on their phone. It is what law enforcement needs to help stop this growing epidemic that is taking the lives of our friends and loved ones. I have spoken with many officers in the central Minnesota region, and they tell me all the time the texting and driving law we have now is hard to enforce. It would be much easier for them if we go with the hands-free law. We are not trying to take away rights, we are trying to save lives. We are trying to prevent people from feeling this pain that is so indescribable. We are trying to prevent this void in other families. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Maurer. I have Josh Toucher that wishes to speak. And then if we would have a couple minutes, if there's someone from the audience who hadn't put their names on the list, if you wish to speak. Good afternoon, sir. Welcome. And please give us your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Josh Tuckshire. I'm an attorney at Meshbesher & Spence. I'm here today in my capacity as the legislative chair for the Minnesota Association for Justice, the trial lawyers group. There are 900 members of us in this state. And we represent families like those that you have heard from today. And we are here in full support of this bill. I applaud the authors for raising this important issue and bringing it all to your attention. We encourage you to take a close look at this bill. Those of you in this member in this committee have the opportunity to make Minnesota roads safer and to avoid unnecessary deaths and serious injuries, which is also a very important aspect of this. Serious injuries that have extraordinary expenses to families by making the roads safer by supporting this bill, and we encourage you to do it. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Is there anyone else then from the audience that wishes to make any comments? All right. Please come forward. We have a few more minutes. We can take some additional comments. Welcome, sir. Give us your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Vijay Dixit, and I'm the father of my daughter, Shreya, who was killed by a distracted driver close to 10 years ago. I now chair a foundation in her memory, and I have been doing a lot of work in educating individuals of all ages, especially the teenagers, that all these friends and the group that has grown since I lost my daughter, Shreya. We do a lot of activities related to distraction-free driving, but somehow doesn't seem to change. 2015 was 411, 2016 is turning out to be close to 412, or maybe even more. I think this is the bill that is just a drop in the ocean, and many of us have said that, oh well, we have to have other types of distractions occurring. Yes, they do occur, but we have to take one step at a time. 3 years ago, 10 years ago, when we started this foundation, distracted drive was the word itself was a tongue twister. Now is a household name. Thank you very much for the opportunity. I didn't prepare my remarks, and I also at this time maybe put in a little word. I wrote a book, One Split Second, in which I tell the story of my friends. Many of them are here, and one of them actually has completely occupied one full chapter. I'm talking about David, Greg, and Peggy's son, David, who was killed. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
So you mentioned education, and I just happened to be talking to White Bear Lake Superintendent, and he said every day in their PSAs, they remind kids, no texting, you know, it's against the law, don't do it. So I wonder, how, you know, is it getting into the culture, do you think? Is it
well,
more
we have to change the culture. Thank you very much for that question. In fact, it's an extremely good question. Our foundation has created what we call the distraction-free driving clubs in four schools in the western suburbs, Eden Prairie, Edina, Hopkins, and Bunnell St. Margaret, where my daughter went to school. And those have been going on for the last 2 years. This is the second year. And I think it's a combination of education, technology, legislation. It's a triangle, and a triangle is the one which is known as three sides. So one of the sides, if you take off, it's no longer a triangle. We have to keep that triangle, and it's a multi-pronged attack that we have to go from three different directions. Thank you.
Thank you, too, very much. I really don't see anyone else then that is interested here in testifying at this time, but we do appreciate so much the people that have come and made your really valuable comments. So I will... Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Hornstein?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just wanted to thank all of the families that came and shared their stories. I'm very proud to work with the authors on this bill, and we've worked on it since summer together, and you know, to me it is really that enforcement piece, the enforcement of the texting piece that's so critically important. And I also wanted to, I talked with the truckers and they wanted me to mention to the committee and to the public that they support the bill as well. So members, again, thank you to Representatives Uglem and Neuberger, and it's one of the few bills, I think, the session that has strong bipartisan support. I think we have almost 30 authors and almost half and half of both parties. So we all feel very strongly about this, and I would encourage everybody to vote yes.
And one question remaining from Representative Barr. Cal?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hornstein, I am one of those professional truck drivers. I've been driving commercially for about 27 years before I landed here in the House of Representatives, and I brought my Bluetooth today. I use it regularly, and just wanted, it's very unintrusive. It's actually better than using the phone with the noise canceling. It prevents a lot of problems just with paying attention with going on, what's going on around you. So I wanted to say to Representative Uglem and Jim Neuberger, thank you for bringing this bill forward. And as this goes through the committee process, I hope to be involved in the additional stops to make this a little bit better. And to the gentleman who testified earlier who takes the bus to work every day, I know exactly what you're talking about. I've seen it for about 4 million miles. I know exactly what you're talking about, and that's why I want to work with you as you go to the next committee stop.
Thank you. And Representative Uglem, you had a question. I'm sorry, Hertas. I'm looking Hertas.
You're confusing me with Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the authors for the work that you're doing in this area. I obtained a cell phone in 1984. That's back when they were hardwired into the trunk of a vehicle. And then they got really good technology where you could have a bag phone on your dash. But they all had a dial pad on the back of the phone. And it seemed like a really tremendous innovation. Before 1984, you had to carry a lot of quarters in your pocket because there were these things called phone booths.
What's that?
And, you know, in the construction trades and in many other industries where people work, quite an advancement in terms of being able to be more productive in, you know, going to meetings and going to job sites and ordering materials. It really was quite an innovation. But phones didn't have cameras or social media. Didn't have all of these other devices as the free market has competed to offer more and more and more on these handheld devices. We all seem so connected now that we have become addicted to being connected. And unfortunately, many of our family and friends expect us to respond within seconds or minutes of sending a message. Before cell phones, there were pagers, and you could even have a little code my wife used to put behind the number to return the phone call. There would be a level of ones as to the level of urgency to get back right away, or even a 911. But as many of you know, I've been working with the Highway 12 Coalition on the Highway of Death in our Metro Twin Cities. And one of the problems is compiling data. And we want to really make sure we're doing the best thing in terms of policy. And I was wondering if anybody from the department could maybe come up to the table, Department of Public Safety or Highway Patrol. Maybe the Highway Patrol would be good. One of the things we're finding is that we have available to us this wonderful crash data booklets that are put together by the Department of Public Safety. But what we learned on the Highway 12 Coalition is a lot of the forms or the little boxes you check when you come to a scene in terms of the collection of data aren't always the best collection of information. And when I've been going through the 2015 data, it lumps everything together in terms of the types of distractions in driving. And I've listened to the family's heartfelt stories, and one would maybe conclude that young people are the culprits. But while I've been sitting here this afternoon I've been compiling data, and I'm finding that it's not necessarily the case that young people are the most responsible for the distracted driving. I've also note that it doesn't really matter what vehicles are involved. I noted here that 20% of crashes in school buses were caused by other drivers, and even 18% by the school bus driver being listed as distracted in some way. I can't imagine how you'd be distracted on a school bus. But same thing with bicycles. 19.8% of the crashes involved there were from other drivers. With trucks, 17.7%, and it appears that this booklet is not talking about commercial vehicles, but SUVs and pickup trucks.
Representative, well, we have a question coming, do we?
I do. Okay. 17.7%, and same thing with motorcycles, all basically in the upper teens to a quartile of probabilities for distracted driving. 25% of all of the crashes listed in this book for 2015 are from distracted driving. So my question to law enforcement is, the forms that you fill out for crashes, what recommendations would you make with regard to more specificity on not only the area of distraction, but even some of the coding that goes on in terms of listing the vehicles and exactly what's going on, whether they're, unless somebody gets sent to a hospital, it's not called a personal injury or severe injury. There's different things that were explained to me by law enforcement on Highway 12. Do you have any recommendations, sir, on the data collection?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's a pretty tough question to answer succinctly. I think that, you know, garbage in, garbage out is always at play with data, and a lot of the stuff that we're asked to evaluate is subjective, level of injury, whether it's fatal, which we know, serious injury, possible injury, no injury is rather subjective. Transport to the hospital or not, of course, is not subjective. One of the challenges when it comes to capturing distracted driving data is getting inside someone's head to know what they were doing or weren't doing. So a common example I used when I was doing reconstruction is that we would oftentimes have a T-bone crash where someone goes through a stop sign and strikes another vehicle. Well, the main factor might be fail to yield to the stop sign, but the actual cause of that crash was that they never saw the stop sign or they were distracted. The short answer is that the newest version of the crash report does a much better job of capturing distraction and then the reason for the distraction. Previously, it was just distracted driving as the code, and now it's hands-free device, cell phone, texting, other. There's a whole drop-down menu of things to select from. So I think moving forward as we get that data analyzed in 2016, and then moving forward, we'll have a much better handle on what's going on. But what we know is, as you pointed out, a couple common themes, distraction is a huge problem on our roads, and it is not at all only teenagers or young drivers. It is across the spectrum of drivers. Nobody is good at distracted driving.
Thank you. And Madam Chair?
Representative Hurtas, briefly follow up?
Yeah. Essentially, you know, what I'm concerned about is getting good data so that we make good policy decisions, and certainly that type of information would be very helpful. What is surprising when you read this data, one would assume that where 65% of the population lives right here in the metro area, where we have all this congestion and we're traveling at 88 feet per second at 60 miles an hour, that taking your eyes off the road for a single second, you're moving halfway down a football field, that you would think that the biggest problem is here in the metro. But as I'm reading this report, three-fourths of the deaths are occurring in rural areas, so it quite antithetical to what you would think. You know, it's actually safer to drive in the metro than it is in a rural area.
So with that, Representative Uglum, do you have a follow-up or a wrap-up, rather? And then
closing comments.
Okay,
Madam
great.
Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, members, you know, I think each and every one of us, when we get elected, we come to the legislature, and each of us, in our own little way, we want to make a difference. We want to do something good. We see a lot of bills. They're maybe not the best bills around, and some of them are very contentious. Some of them have some support, some of them don't. this is a bill that we have to act on. This is a good bill. You've heard from everybody here today, tragic. And I really feel it's incumbent on me to bring this bill forward. I'm very pleased to have Representative Neuberger and Representative Hornstein in a bipartisan manner working on this. And I hope that all of you can become part of the team here so we can address this horrible problem. Get it done. Move it forward.
Thank you, Representative Ugrin. And I'm going to renew my motion that House File 1180 be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and the bill is on its way.
Thank you
very much.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
And as the room is sort of clearing out, I'm going to take up House File 1160, and that's in your packet. 1160 was before the committee about a week or so ago, and there's no new testimony on it. We're simply referring it to the Committee on State Government as amended. So. So I'm going to repeat that. So I'm going to move House Files 1160 as amended, be back before the committee, and recommend that it be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. Is there any discussion on the motion or on the bill? If not, 1160, and that's... Mm-hmm.
As amended, then.
As amended, right. Okay. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
All right. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion does prevail. Next, we'll go on to House File 1821, Representative Petersburg. What exactly do I? Oh, you have language. Okay. Explaining. Okay. Good. Representative Petersburg, welcome. And want to move your bill, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 1821 be referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Okay, you want to go ahead and explain your bill, please, Representative?
Well, I'm going to explain it briefly, but I have a person over to my left that has a lot more experience and knowledge about it, and he will give further testimony as well. Briefly, this is two parts. The first part deals with two agencies, Department of Revenue and the Department of Transportation, that are both involved in regards to the sale of aircraft, and they need information from each other. Previously to this bill, they had the owner of the or the seller of the airplane had to run back and forth between them. This just allows the two agencies to be able to share the pertinent information only for the purpose of that particular transaction. And the other half of the bill has to do with when people create shell companies or other ways in which they're trying to eliminate the responsibility of paying for licensures and so forth of automobiles. Both of these have to do with case law, and they're just dealing with putting it in statute so that we get to do what we need to do. And with that, I would turn it over to Mr. Paul Cummings from the Department of Revenue.
Good afternoon, Mr. Cummings.
Good afternoon.
Just a description, please, of the bill.
Yes. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I wanted to thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing the bill, and I wanted to thank you, Representative Petersburg, for authoring the bill. This bill contains transportation-related policy provisions from the Department of Revenue's policy bill. Section of the one deals with the disclosure provision with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. It is to amend 270B to allow the commissioner to disclose return information to DOT that is necessary to administer tax for taxpayers that own or operate registered aircraft. Current statutes do not allow for the exchange of information between DOR and DOT that would be useful when approving annual registration in aircraft that is operated in Minnesota. Taxpayers must provide proof of sales tax payment to the DOT for registration. So, for example, Madam Chair, a Minnesota taxpayer purchased an aircraft from an individual who is not a licensed aircraft dealer in the states, and use tax is due on the transaction. The taxpayer reports and pays the use tax on the Minnesota sales and use tax return. In order for the DOT to register the aircraft, the owner must present them with proof of the use tax paid. The taxpayer is instructed to print copies of payment confirmation from our e-services account at DOR. Sometimes taxpayers forget to print out their receipt even though use tax has been paid, leaving them really frustrated at the DOT. So this proposal will allow the DOT to verify that use tax has been paid when a customer is registering an aircraft. Madam Chair, Section 2 deals with bringing in case law into statute. It really clarifies the motor vehicle sales tax presumption statute so that the presumption at law is that when a foreign entity purchases a motor vehicle that is under the control of a Minnesota resident, the Minnesota resident owes the motor vehicle sales tax if they meet the conditions as you see listed in the bill. For example, it has no physical presence in the state, and it fails to file federal tax returns or required state tax returns in the state in which it's organized. And the Minnesota resident is presumed to be in control of the vehicle if the resident is a partner, member, or shareholder of a business entity that made the purchase, is insured to drive in the state, and operates or stores a vehicle in Minnesota. So related to the motor vehicle sales tax, this proposal helps to create some equity by dealing with some of the unintended consequences that allowed some taxpayers to think that they are avoiding paying the same tax and other taxpayers must pay. You and your neighbor, Madam Chair, both have cars. Use them and store them in Minnesota. You pay the motor vehicle sales tax, but your neighbor may have a shell corporation in another state where they register their vehicles to evade Minnesota taxes. If that is the case, both you and your neighbor must pay the motor vehicle sales tax. The outcome for the taxpayers would not change due to this law change, but each are liable for the tax. However, the current basis for how these cases are handled is in case law. As I mentioned before, we rely on case law to make our assessments. We have seen instances where people set up shell corporations on Montana for this sole purpose. To be clear, this bill does not raise or lower taxes. It does not create or take away exemptions. It doesn't create or take away tax liability. And the language is modeled after laws from other states, Nebraska and Iowa, and the case law. There are other presumptions in statutes that motor vehicles sold for delivery here are sold for the use here, and when the application for registration plates is made within 30 days of the purchase, it is presumed it is made for use in the state. So there are other presumptions that are had in law. So with that, Madam Chair, I thank you for the opportunity to testify today. It is good to be in front of your committee again, Madam Chair. I know that this is a different committee, but it is good to be in front of your committee again, and we thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Thank you, Mr. Cummins. Seems like a bill that, you know, should have been done long ago.
Yes, Madam Chair.
But case law has been sufficient then.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. All right. Is there other questions about the bill? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Petersburg, I will renew your motion that House File 1821 be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion does prevail. 1821 is referred to taxes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Committee.
And Representative Albright is here. House File 1866. Good afternoon, Representative. I will move your bill, House File 1866, and that's going to be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. And I see you have a DE amendment, so I will move the DE-1 to get the bill in the shape that you're looking for. Those in favor of the DE amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The DE amendment, which transforms House File 1866, does a number of things. Let me start by thanking you for having an audience before your committee. And with that, I'll just refer you to, for your own purposes, the bill summary that was prepared by Ms. Dyson, and I'll just walk through that very quickly. Section 1 is a section that deals with the prevention of regional railroad authorities from spending funds for study, development, or construction of light rail transit. Section 2 goes to the point of the legislative opportunity for approval of light rail projects. Section 3 is metropolitan governance, where we are, in a sense, establishing a new paradigm for the membership and the governance terms. Subdivision 2A talks about the terms. Subdivision 2B talks about the representation from the various council districts. In Subdivision 3, we are identifying compensation for the membership as well as for the chair. Redistricting is under Section Subdivision 3A. The appointment and the authority for voting is under Subdivision 9. Section 4 of the DE talks about the development guide for transportation, directing the Met Council to set a fare box recovery objective of 60% by 2022. Section 5 talks about the transportation planning, eliminating the Transportation Advisory Board. Section 6 talks about the prevention of the Met Council from spending funds for the study, development, or construction of light rail projects unless it's specifically authorized by the legislature. Section 7 talks about the project development requirements of co-location for those both freight and for light rail. Section 8 talks about the requirements, alternatives, and benefit analysis subjected to a light rail consideration. Section 9 talks about a report that would be necessarily provided to the enacting board 60 days, within 60 days. Section 10 talks about a transportation policy plan update, requiring the council to revise its transportation policy by December 31st of 2017. And Section 11 subjects specific law authorizing to light rail projects found in Section 7 and 8 applicable to light rail construction. Members, this is not a subject that is, by any stretch of the imagination, new. We have, for countless years, talked about the governance structure and the responsibilities of the Met Council. Let me just give you a little background, if you will. I understand brevity is my friend today, so I won't belabor the point. But the chronology of events that lead us to the consideration of why I believe it's important for us to take up a reformation of the Met Council. The Met Council itself was created as a regional planning and coordinating body back in 1967. And throughout the years, there have been addendums to that where they have collected much, I appreciate, almost like a magnet to nails, attracting responsibilities to the point of, in 1969, they acquired the responsibility for local the regional wastewater treatment system. 1974, the Metropolitan Parks and Open Spaces Act was added, as well as the Metropolitan Housing and Redevelopment Act. 1976, another Metropolitan Land Planning Act. 1977, Metropolitan Sports Facilities Commission. 1984, the Regional Transit Board was established. 1989, the Metropolitan Airport Planning Act. 1993, the State Advisory Council was undertaken to look at the reorganization of the Met Council. In 1995, the Metropolitan Livable Communities Act was added. And in 2001, we actually commissioned a study of the metropolitan governance structure I will note, and I think it's notable, that the OLA undertook a very comprehensive review of the metropolitan governance in 2014. And as that study certainly identifies, we have some issues that we need to address. The state of Minnesota and the governance structure of the Met Council really has come about because of an abdication of the responsibilities of the legislature. We have not undertaken the tough decisions that, in my opinion, should have been, and if they were, we would not be sitting here today. And so with that, we are at the point where, on an annual basis, we come to the point where we say, what are we going to do about the Met Council? What are we going to do? You hear testimony both for and against, and I think that just subjects us to an even greater understanding of that this is a subject that will not go away. It is about governance, and governance leads to responsibilities. It goes to an intrusion and or an adherence to regulations and policies that may not be of the making for the people that they serve, although they are, in some cases, acquiescence to those studies. And so what you will hear today are both those that are in favor of the governance reformation methodologies that we're going to undertake, and you will also hear those that feel that it's just fine. This is not a partisan issue. It is bipartisan. I have people on both sides of the aisle that are strongly in support of measures to reform. It's just a matter of how far we go. And so with that, I would actually urge, this is a governance issue, but it is about the governor, whomever that is, to undertake an understanding in terms of the role and responsibility that the Met Council has to the state and the Metropolitan Planning Organization and what they intend to do about it, whether they are sitting as the governor now or in the years to come. I think it's an executive action that we can put forward. And I would welcome the conversation not only with this committee but with the governor on this matter so that we can move the metropolitan area forward so that it serves everyone as best as possible. And with that, Madam Chair, I welcome conversation. I understand there are a number of amendments that we'll undertake for this bill as well.
Well, and Representative, there also are probably six testifiers, about half in favor, half opposed. Would you like to do the amendments first or have some testimony?
I'll leave that to your discretion. I'm happy to take up the amendments first to put the bill in the shape that we'll pass it forward.
Okay. All right. We have the A1 amendment. And Representative Hertaus, is that yours?
It is, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Describe your amendment, please.
All right. To the author and members, the A1 amendment basically requires that the Met Council by February 15th of each year present a proposed budget for the next calendar year to the legislative committees with jurisdiction over the Met Council and specifically to committees with jurisdiction over transportation, the environment, housing, as well as committees in Ways and Means and the House of Representatives and the Committee on the Finance and the Senate. And then once that is approved, then they can move forward with certifying their necessary levy to conform with their budget expectations as approved by the legislature. So what this does is bring some legislative oversight onto the spending. One of the problems, Madam Chair and members, is that this organization has been allowed to grow and grow and grow, and it is the only regional planning organization, as mentioned by the author, that is unelected. And as the region has grown in the jurisdiction of this region, it really has become a prize for the executive office in terms of governance over a large part of Minnesota and its population. And I say that in a bipartisan way. It matters not which executive or which party controls the governor's office, but that really has become a collateral prize for winning the executive branch. So this is an attempt to through the duly elected representatives from each legislative district. It's proportional and allows the legislature to have oversight and brings the financing of the Met Council under control of the legislature. Thank you.
Representative Hertaus, I'm going to ask you to move your amendment, first of all.
Thank you. I will move the H-1866-A1 amendment.
Very good. Okay. So, discussion, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question for Representative Hertaus, and I have other comments which I'll discuss in conjunction with my amendments. But, Representative Hertaus, we have a legislative commission on metropolitan governance, and that actually meets usually, I think it's actually required in statute that that legislative commission meet to discuss the Met Council's budget, pretty much similar to the description of your amendment. And I've served on that commission since I've got here. And so we meet always in December. The Met Council goes over its annual budget with us. There are members from both parties and the House and the Senate. And, you know, we get into some pretty detailed conversations with the Met Council about their budget. So why would we do this? It seems like a little duplicative because this you're talking about February 15th. We're meeting usually in early to mid-December. And there aren't other legislative oversight commissions over other executive branch agencies. And I think we can agree this has become more or less an executive branch agency. Where I agree with you, where I agree with Representative Albright is, in fact, the stop for some of our efforts, bipartisan efforts, has been the governor of either party, starting back when Governor Carlson vetoed Representative Orfield's elected Met Council bill. So it goes all back. We can go through the whole sort of history on this. But I just don't think this is necessary because we already have an oversight commission. And I joked with some of you on the other side of the aisle when we heard something similar when we talked about this last time, which is I don't want to give you ideas to have oversight commissions for the PCA and the DNR and the Department of Health. I don't think we need those. But we do have it for the Metropolitan Council in place, and it works well. So why would we do this?
Representative Hornstein, if I could, so the amendment, yes, there is an oversight commission, but the amendment actually goes beyond that and actually says that their budget does not get increased unless there is affirmative approval of that by the legislature.
Right, but thank you, Madam Chair. My point is we already have a commission to do this, and now we're going even way beyond that to do budget oversight over a executive branch agency that we don't do with any other. We don't do this with any other. And this, their budget is minuscule in terms of the general fund compared to the Health and Human Services budget or the education budget. And so I just think this is real. It's overkill. We don't need this. We already have something very unique in place that we don't have for anyone else in terms of the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Governance. So, Madam Chair, I just don't think this is necessary, and I would oppose it.
Yes, Representative Hornstein, I wonder if we could just get some clarification from Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the A1 amendment, the date changes and the are to fit into a legislative schedule. What is changing here is that the legislature would have to enact a law authorizing the budget each year for the Met Council. It's not just oversight, it's enacting the budget. If the legislature fails to enact by August 1st, which is the beginning of the levy cycle, since the Met Council is a political subdivision on a calendar year, not a state fiscal year, it would affect the ability of the council to change its levies. Then, so that's why it's, the legislature would have to act by August 1st. The council then is frozen at the previous year and how that interacts with any other obligations of the council would have to be figured out. But and you'll see the same provision in the section on page 2 where it talks about the levy. This is the general levy for the council, but the levy, the legislature establishes levy limits for the council, but the levy can't, this sets the timing for that levy to tie it to the budget. But the legislature already sets the levy limits for the council.
So, yeah, thank you for that clarification. Is there any other discussion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Joachim?
Maybe since this is such a substantial change, sorry, it's already been a long day, to the way Met Council would have to budget and look at projects going forward and maintain sewer systems and water systems and transit systems and countless others. Could maybe the Met Council come forward and explain how this change would affect your future planning and projects that are already in the queue?
Sure. Mr. Shetland, please come forward. We welcome your comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Judd Shetland with the Metropolitan Council. And related to the amendment, part of my comments were going to be related to what Representative Hornstein mentioned, relating to the fact that we do have the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Governance, where every year I bring forward a draft, the council's draft budget, and provide that to the 14 metro members who serve on that commission. That specifically, and I pulled up the language here, that they monitor, review, and make recommendations on the council's tax rate and dollar amounts, any requests for increase in the debt, our overall work and role of the council, the council's proposed operating capital budgets, the council's implementation of the capital budgets work program and capital investment programs. And so what we do otherwise is with the dollars that we receive through the state, we participate through the state budgeting process like anyone else. And so when we do that, we come before the Transportation Finance Committee or the Environment Finance Committee, the Legacy Committees, the Bonding Committees, and we have those conversations with the state. I think adding this layer of the Legislative Commission should provide, and I think at the time, back when it was Representative Krenke, Senator Cohen had this language, and it was Senator Rest, and at the time it was Representative Dan McElroy, who this was all played out as part of the State Government Finance Bill in 2001. And this was done exactly for the purpose I think that Representative Hertas was looking for at the time. Maybe that has changed since then. But it was to make sure that the legislature has an opportunity to look at the work program. But to what Ms. Dyson said, the state does set our levy limits for how we move forward with our livable communities levies, our general levies, basically anything we do, including our regional transit bonding funds. We get the legislature to provide those funds for us. But to what Representative Joachim is asking, that is actually a better question probably for the cities, because we operate as a political subdivision and we work on a calendar year, so we can work with cities and counties in order to set our rates so they can build them into their programs and have those ready. Because if we're not able to provide that information to them, then they are going to have difficulty preparing their budgets and bringing those forward for the next year. So just so members know, about 38% of our overall budget is state funds. Everything else is done through transit fares or wastewater fees, federal money that comes into to the council. And those are the conversations that we have as part of the Legislative Commission. And I do this so I can tell you with certainty that I provide that information to every one of those members over the course of the interim so that we can have that robust conversation with the Legislative Commission. So that information is always there. It's always available. I know I'm always available to provide that information as well, and I think that would be pretty difficult. One other thing I'd like to mention, and Representative Albright is correct, that many of this isn't a new conversation, but in the Delete All Amendment, we've got, Madam Chair, your House File 418, we've got House File 1150, and House File 628, which are brand new to this conversation. The governance discussion has been around, and we've been through this, but I just want to add to make sure that folks know that the other provisions in the Delete All Amendment are new issues that are new to this conversation that we want to make sure that comes out. And also, Madam Chair, I just wanted to make sure I didn't hear where the bill said it was going to go, but I was wondering if it was going to the GovOps based on
government operations. Also,
okay,
Mr.
that's what I just
Mr.
wanted
Shetland.
To make sure.
Okay.
So thank you, Madam Chair, and I can
to the amendment. Are there other comments? Did you have any follow up or wrap up then, Ms. Representative Hertas?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you know, the reason for the February 15th, Representative Hornstein, is to allow the newly elected that may be sworn in in the first of the year to really have oversight and to have some input in it. It's one thing to be appointed to advisory boards and commissions. It's another thing to really represent the people that are going to be affected within the Metropolitan Council's governance region or area to have their representatives, state representatives, have an opportunity to have some input or oversight on that. Thank you.
Representative Kosnick?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And perhaps Mr. Shetland, do you know what was the, you'd mentioned the date in the Legislative Commission, what was the date that they were reviewed the budget, and maybe you kind of talked about it a little bit for 2016?
Mr. Shetland.
Madam Chair, and Representative Kosnick, I know that I provided the draft public comment in October.
Okay.
And I believe that the Legislative Commission met in December. I can tell you that from Met Council staff position, I don't pick the date for when the commission is going to meet, but I can tell you that the day that the council adopts the draft public hearing, I provide that to all the members to ensure that there's plenty of time in order for me to answer any type of questions or provide any information that people are looking for.
Madam Chair?
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Shetland. You know, just kind of looking on the website, it appeared, and my concern was, and if the members on that commission have some of that information, but it didn't seem like there was a meeting until, like, maybe, I want to say maybe December 16th, and then the budget is approved, like, the very next day. So I'm just curious if that provides enough time for the commission members to actually absorb the magnitude of that budget. If you want to comment on that, or actually,
Mr.
actually
Mr.
A re- representative.
And I was at that commission meeting, and I think it's an hour and a half, maybe 2 hour long meeting, which, you know, given the depth and the breadth of the Met Council budget, probably isn't anywhere adequate to actually really do a job. So,
great. Well, Madam,
Mr. Shetland.
Madam Chair and members, this may have been a unique circumstance for this last budget. However, this commission has been in place since 2001. And so I can tell you over time, there have been a number of years where we've had a number of meetings, and there have been other years when there have not. But I am not in the position to compel this group to meet, but I am in a position to have to provide all the information that statute requires for this commission to be able to do the work that they want.
Right, Madam Chair?
Representative Kosnick, follow-up quickly.
Thank you, and that was good clarification, but so it reaffirmed to me that perhaps the commission isn't as strong as it should be or could be, and I think that's what the amendment addresses. But at the December Legislative Commission on the Metropolitan Governance, the Met Council meeting about the Met Council's budget, the Met Council kind of failed to mention that they were the deficit that they were preparing for. So how would the commission be able to have oversight if they aren't told what the true budget situation is? And, you know, that was kind of a big concern.
Shannon.
Mr. Chair and members, what we were bringing forward in the Legislative Commission was our annual operating capital budget. It was not the budget that we were going to negotiate with the legislature. And those numbers that occurred as part of what we're dealing with today were related to the November, early December forecast numbers, which brings forward the conversation again that we have with Chair Torkelson and Chair Newman in the Senate and the members of the Transportation Policy and Transportation Finance Committees related to motor vehicle sales tax, metro mobility, those types of issues. What we had at this meeting on mid-December was related to the Council's annual operating and capital budget, which are different.
Madam Chair, I think my point was made that there was some significant financial information that was omitted, so I'll let it go there. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative. All right. There are no further questions. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make a quick clarification. And you've been around here long enough, you know that a lot of the LCC committees that we direct and create are only as strong as their chairs. The organization that's reporting to them can't make up the time they're going to meet. They don't set the agenda. It's incumbent upon the chairs to call those meetings. And if there's more meetings that need to be called, that's the chairs. And that's the Senate or the House chair of that legislative committee. I haven't served on this commission yet. I got lucky enough to be appointed for this year. I'm looking forward to having a lot more meetings, maybe, depending on who the chair is. But one insight that Representative Hurtaw has mentioned, he said that it's important for the folks that are being affected by this budget to be able to talk about it. And I think that's why it was great to add that extra layer of the LCC committee, and it's made up of legislators that are in the metropolitan area and that are responsive to the constituents that are being affected by this. So just wanted to throw that out there, too. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Representative Albright.
Madam Chair and members, since we're on the topic of the LCMG, as the current chair for the LCMG, I can speak to that point, Representative Youakim, and I don't take any offense at the point of maybe not being responsive to it, but I think in the last year we've had certainly a couple of occurrences, one being an election where we had to understand or appreciate the timing of the a meeting that was held in December, and that certainly when you're trying to arrange the schedules for any number of 20 folk or so, as well as their staffs and the preparation of materials, you can begin to appreciate the complexity of making sure everyone's there so that we can convene a quorum and converse about the issues that are before us. So I think that in light of that, when I undertook the responsibility as the chair for that commission, I actually had a sit-down with Ms. Dyson and really looked at the statute that would govern the activities of the LCMG. And it came to my attention, unfortunately, that the commission is a bit of a toothless lion from the standpoint of it gathers information, it can hear testimony, but from the perspective of other than just making a recommendation, there's no autonomous authority given to the commission to make other than just recommendations to a higher body. So it is a bit of a pass-through, albeit one where we can, as some are very capable and have accomplished good things in terms of highlighting issues on the Met Council. That being said, the unfortunate circumstances that the commission, in order to be strengthened, would have to have a statutory change. And that's why, in regard to the A1 amendment, I find it intriguing what Representative Hertas has brought forward, that as he has well said, it brings a bit of perspective to that from an authoritative perspective by the legislative members of the body to bear on the council's budget.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Bernardi, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I could wait on this question, but it just made me, when you were talking about a toothless, I can't remember.
A toothless lion.
I was just wondering, in your legislation that you have here, and I can always wait and ask this later, but you're developing a lot of expansion of government, and the committee that you have for the local governments to meet once a month, I believe that's what the last thing I knew that was in your bill. Is that a toothless lion, or what was your intent for them to meet monthly?
Representative
Chair,
Albright.
Representative Bernardi, I'd be happy to respond to that. I don't recall the specific section that that's pertaining to. But the expansion of, and maybe this is where the question is going, the expansion to the council itself, I think is an indication of expansion of the toothless line, if you will, that metaphor, but actually a better representation of the people, the municipalities, and the organizations that are represented by the Met Council and their MPO. If you take a look, and I'll just draw your attention just for the sake of some numbers, not to belabor the point, but the region that is governed by the MPO considers 54% of the state's population. It also includes 142 cities, 42 towns, as well as other districts. So it isn't a small enterprise, and there are a number of constituencies within that, but I think bringing a greater breadth to the council itself, I think, gives better representation amongst those that are elected and hold an election certificate.
Just about one.
Right, Representative Bernardi, quick follow-up.
Okay, what I'm just trying to figure out is I was kind of taken back about the reasons not for holding the hearing for the current, that you're the chair of, the current committee. I'm just wondering how these people that are serving kind of well, two capacities, serving as a committee for the Met Council type committee, I don't know what you call it, and they're also elected officials, how would they find time every single month to meet to do this when it's difficult, it sounds like, for the legislators who have that responsibility to
I wonder, Representative, if maybe some we could get to that online, perhaps, as far as an answer to that, if we could.
Yeah, and maybe we can talk about it.
So to the amendment, members, seeing no further questions, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
The A1 amendment passes. Prevails. All right, the A2 amendment. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment is in response to the new federal rule which allows the Met Council authority to use transportation planning outside the seven-county metro area. This amendment does not prohibit compliance entirely, but it does delay compliance until after we've had a better idea of what the entire urbanized area is going to be after the 2020 census is complete. This will give all the all of us the necessary time to consider where this will be expanding to.
Very good. Are there questions on the amendment? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
The amendment prevails. And we have the A5 amendment. Is that yours, Representative Hornstein?
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a couple of Met Council-related bills, and this was we heard this one, members, so I'm not going to go over it too extensively in the interest of time. But this had to do with staggered terms. It was the Citizens League recommendation. They had a stakeholder group that met extensively. And then it also reforms or adds some responsibilities for an expanded and more robust nominating committee. And I guess the point I wanted to make to the author, who I respect so much, he's done a lot of thinking on this, and we're not that far off, I think, on a number of items here. And Representative Albright, you and Representative Hertas were spot on. How are we going to move something through the legislature that the executive branch will take seriously and possibly even sign? And that's been really, Madam Chair, the crux of the matter. I like to joke, or maybe not joke, because it's true that I had been involved in Met Council governance reform since I walked in here in 2003, before it was as fashionable as it is now. But, you know, every single one of these efforts, whether I had been the author or others, I had cited my predecessor, Representative Warfield's elected Met Council bill. Governor Carlson vetoed it. We had some initiatives that Governor Pawlenty vetoed. We had a staggered terms not too dissimilar from this one that Governor Dayton vetoed. And, you know, we had a meeting with the governor a couple weeks ago. Chair Ron Beck was there. I raised the issue with him that I think bipartisanly we would like to see some governance reform. So what I'm trying to get at with this amendment is something that, and the subsequent amendment, the A6, is getting to a place where we can have that conversation with the executive branch, where we can move forward on something. And I just don't think that House File 1866 is going to do the job. And so I'm being pragmatic with this. We have a stakeholder group that's included a lot of folks, the business community, others, that have come up with this idea. It's something not too dissimilar from your ideas last year. I want to give you credit. You had proposed this last year. So this isn't anything that we haven't seen. This isn't anything that has been not thoroughly vetted. It has been thoroughly vetted by a lot of folks, even outside the legislature. So I'm offering the A5 as a pragmatic option that I think that can move us forward on governance reform this year. And again, I don't know whether the governor would sign this or not. I have a little better sense of on the A6, but I offer it in that spirit that this is not something new. It's not something that has not been vetted. And again, I think we have some bipartisan buy-in for this. So I appreciate the support for the A5.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Any further discussion on the amendment? Okay. Hearing none, then, all in favor of the A5 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. All right. The motion does not prevail. The motion is not adopted.
I didn't hear any opposition.
I lost my script. Okay, let's try that again. Okay. All those in favor of the A5 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. The motion does not prevail. Motion is not adopted. All right. Division is called. All those in favor, raise your hand. The A5 amendment. Those opposed, also raise your hand. On a vote of 7 no's and 6 ayes, the amendment does not prevail. It's not adopted. All right, the A6 amendment, please.
Okay, thanks again, Madam Chair. And this one I think we might have a shot at. I know that last year I talked with some folks in the executive branch and they did not rule this out. I have not had more recent conversations. But, members, this is inspired, actually, by the really great, Ms. Dyson, I want to compliment you on your overview of the history of Met Council governance and the Met Council overall that we had in January, one of our first meetings. And if you'll recall, in Ms. Dyson's presentation, the last major governance change took place as a result of a legislatively mandated, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. Dyson, a legislatively mandated task force similar to what's in this bill, or in this amendment, A6, back in, I believe, 94, it could have been 93, 94, she says, okay. And as a result of that task force, we had significant, the last time we had governance reform or governance change that was agreed to by the legislature and the governor was the result of this type of task force. So I did my best here, members of this amendment, to bring all the stakeholders together. We have city government. We have county government. I think I have something related to CTIB. We're going to have to change that because I think CTIB may not exist after today. But you know, so we can tweak this. But we have counties, we have cities, we have the Chamber of Commerce, we have labor, all the stakeholders of the Met Council coming together, and that they will do something similar to what was done in 1994, and that is make recommendations to the legislature as to what this governance structure ultimately needs to be. So we would, if we were to approve this amendment, Madam Chair, today, we would be able a year from now to vote in a governance change that has been, vetted thoroughly again by this task force that we, the legislature, have appointed. So I hope and I trust that this would be something the governor certainly could sign, and it would move us further along in governance, whereas I think that the approach that we're taking today will certainly get vetoed and will stop the conversation. And we don't need that, members. I think there's enough interest in governance that we should move something forward. Instead, I think we're just going to be spinning our wheels like we've done the last 10 years or longer. So I hope we can do the 8-6, and that will move us forward.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. I wonder if Representative Albright has a comment.
Madam Chair and members, Representative Hornstein and I share an affinity for a number of things, particularly good food and conversation. And I have the deepest admiration and respect for his observations about the Met Council, and I want to make those public again. This or similar language was included in a bill that I put forward in the last biennium, very similarly. But over the interim, as I looked at a couple things, one is the work that Mr. Noble has put forward a number of years ago in his OLA report with regard to governance. It morphed into a governance issue by way of what he was really charged with. But I'll also draw attention in the workup that Ms. Dyson prepared. I'll just draw your attention to the fact that the Metropolitan Government Reorganization Act which actually made recommendations to a number of other planning functions. The proposal actually made recommendation to move towards an elected body. Ms. Dyson can correct me if I'm wrong in one of the recommendations. But that proposal actually failed by one vote. So this is not a new a consideration in terms of an elected body to the Met Council. That being said, why wouldn't I include the task force in my bill or going forward? And candidly, I think to Representative Hornstein's credit, and also but for what Mr. Nobles has done, I think it's already been accomplished. And I think the roadmap that we can find through the OLA report with some addendums and just an update has already been accomplished for us. I mean, no disrespect to the author of the amendment, but I think that the work has already been done, and we just need to get moving forward on what we all need is an accomplishable task. We just need to kind of find a good, solid ground for all of us to stand on.
Is there any further discussion on the amendment, the A6? Hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign.
Aye.
The amendment does not prevail, and the amendment is not adopted. All right. So then we'll move on to the vote on the House File 1866. And there are, well, actually, there are possibly people who wish to testify first. So I wonder if they're available. We had a few folks. Mayor Bob Crawford. Let's see, Mr. Crawford, Mr. Hargis. Okay, well, please come to the witness stand, please. Good afternoon and welcome to the committee, and please give us your name for the record, sir.
Thank you. I'm Bill Hargis from Woodbury. I'm the former mayor of Woodbury. I served in that capacity for 18 years. I also have been a member, past member of the Regional Transportation Advisory Board for 20 years. I was mayor of our community for about 18, and also served as chair of that. I was also on the Citizen League Task Force, but part of the minority report on that. With that background, I just want to make clear that my comments are my personal opinions and of experiences, but and I do want to say up front, I don't have a cross to bear with the Met Council. I've had a pretty good relationship with the different people that have served there. But I am here today speaking in favor of elected officials being on the Met Council. I'm a supporter of representative government. I think those that have gone through an elected process understand that better and bring something to the table, particularly in the form of representative government. And I don't think we should ever be afraid of representative government. Elected officials serve as the majority on the Transportation Advisory Board. They always brought a regional perspective to that. I know there's a concern of having elected officials on the Met Council having a conflict of interest. I didn't really experience that on a Transportation Advisory Board. If it maybe come up in an instance or two, that soon got corrected with people that really wanted to focus on the region. We need to have a strong region, strong representative government. When the Citizen League Task Force convened, I think, to use Representative Hornstein's, they kind of took a limited or what you would call a pragmatic approach of what could be done. Because I asked early on, are you going to look at a blank sheet of paper, what should it be or could it be? And unfortunately, the group kind of focused on a more pragmatic or limited approach. Just to summarize, I don't think you need to be afraid of elected officials. You understand the process and kind of what goes through. They bring a perspective, the different ways elected officials could be on the Met Council. I'm not here to speak for any one, but I think if the cities and counties sent some elected officials to the Met Council, that group would hold those people accountable. Those people would be focused on the region, and I think that's really what the whole purpose of the Met Council is to make sure our region treats people fairly and we are competitive with other regions throughout the country and the world. So,
very good. Thank you, Mayor Hargis.
Thank you.
Is Mr. Fletcher? Oh, is there a comment? Okay. Question from Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question of the testifier. What do you think the objective is of the current Met Council if it's not dealing with the region?
I think that it does deal with the region, but it is partisan. Depends on they're all governor. They're really accountable to the governor, and we've heard that defense of or rebuttal to ideas that have been advanced. I've lived in Minnesota since 1970, and this is a continual argument about who composes, who appoints. And I just think if you have a broader base of appointments and through the elected officials, you're going to have a bipartisan Met Council. It's not going to have the swings with basically who the governor's office is. And it is a regional metropolitan issue, and it's not really a statewide issue.
Representative Bernardi.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And I have a question for you regarding the entirety, more parts of this bill. And my question for you is, said we don't need to be scared of local government. The local government has been making decisions about multimodal transportation, whether it's roads and starting projects or, starting projects and figuring out what's best for the community. What do you think about putting a prohibition on LRT projects without legislative authority, taking away the authority of the city councils and local officials?
Mr. Hargis.
That's a kind of a loaded question. I know, my experience on the Transportation Advisory Board, I was a skeptic on LRT to begin with, and basically the Transportation Advisory Board got behind those projects. So I think a well-reasoned, a bipartisan Met Council can move those projects forward if there is the true support for those.
Right. Representative Mason?
Just a question, again, since you served on the City Council, where do you think most projects originate? Do they originate with the Met Council, or do they start at the local level and move up?
There's both. It comes with the counties and the cities, and we work with our, in Woodbury, we had to work with our county, we had to work with our adjoining cities to be able to advance something that's going to affect our region.
Okay.
Representative Mason?
So follow. Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's been my experience, because I've served on a city council as well, and usually it's the cities that are getting together, and then in some cases, like the red line started with the county. But again, all of this starts at the local level and moves up. It's not the fact that the Met Council is determining this. It's after the locals have done that. And what you're saying is you're okay if it starts at the Met Council level. And if you look at the bill that's being addressed here, it totally takes away the ability of local government to even spend money, to even study anything. So
I'm not going to try to weigh in.
Mr. Mayor.
I didn't mean to weigh in on the LRT debate. I know, my experience has been that projects do and ideas do come from the local level, and I don't think that needs to change with elected people on the Met Council. I was really here to address that. I wasn't trying to weigh in on the controversial issue of the LRTs.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. And I believe we have Mr. Fletcher. Is he available? Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee, and please give us your name for the record.
Sure. My name is Tom Fletcher. I'm a city council member in the city of Greenwood since 2008. For you folks that have no clue where Greenwood is, we're a small city, about 700 people, in the west end of Hennepin County, right by Excelsior. I am here on behalf of the city of Greenwood. We're members of the coalition to support the
governance sections of the House File 1866 as it relates to reform of the Met Council. I believe that the appointment process provides greater continuity than the current system, and also that the proposed bottom-up process would connect local communities more closely with decisions regarding sewer utilities, transportation, and planning. The legislation also includes a formal process for ongoing communication with the Met Council. I might note that I heard mention that that was monthly meetings. The way I read the copy, it's quarterly meetings. So, and this was advocated by the cities, and that way you have a communication. In other words, you don't just send somebody out, and 2 years later they come back and report that quarterly there's a formal quarterly dialogue, and that seems about the right number. I know there's also been questions on conflict of interest. As part of the City of Greenwood, I'm a member, and I chaired for a couple of years the Excelsior Fire District, which has five cities, and I'm on the Lake Minnetonka Communication Commission, where I'm the vice chair. And, you know, what you find is that, yes, cities have differences, but at these boards, we seem to get together pretty well and work them out. You know what I'm saying? Most times the votes are 5-0 on these things. Sometimes they don't go the same way, but just like anywhere else, we get together, and my observation has been that we've been very nonpartisan in the past. In fact, I can't tell you what party anybody comes from on my council or on the fire boards or whatever. It's more focused on what makes sense for our communities. That's my comments.
Very good. Thanks for your comments. We'll move on. We have Mr. Kershaw, Ms. Nelman, are they available? Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, pardon me. It's been a long afternoon. Madam Chair and members, Patricia Nauman, I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities, representing 90 cities in the metropolitan area, or 95% of the region's population at the Legislature, Executive Branch, and Metropolitan Council. Madam Chair, I have testified on many of the provisions in this bill as it was moving along under House File 828, so I will not repeat a lot of that testimony, but I do just want to emphasize and maybe focus on a couple of pieces as you do consider this bill, and that it really does relate to the what we consider to be the inherent incompatibility associated with holding the office of local city or county official and Metropolitan Council member. I would encourage the committee to think about these issues as you weigh this legislation and the creation of a governance structure, whether it be the Metropolitan Council's governance or any other entity, frankly, in which ethical concerns and the inevitability of conflicts of interest or the perception of are baked into the model. This model builds a structure in which there are likely to be, if not actual conflicts of interest, the perception of conflicts of interest for local officials. And perceptions of conflict are as good as actual conflicts. The language in the bill does state that the offices are compatible. My understanding of that is that does make these offices legally compatible. We would argue that it does not make them practically compatible, that you would still face the inevitable conflicts and divided loyalties acting in both capacities of local official and Metropolitan Council member. Local officials are elected by their community. The role of a Met Council member is a separate and distinct function where city officials' loyalties and counties would be inevitably tested and divided on a very continual basis. It has been discussed that there is not another entity, not today, but at other hearings, that there's not another entity like the Metropolitan Council in the country. That is true. I would argue that some of the provisions in this bill, which you're expanding the size of the Metropolitan Council and adding transportation representatives, I would just like to remind the committee that the Metropolitan Council is more than a funder and provider of transportation and transit dollars. It's more than an MPO. It has other functions, many of which have high intersection with local officials across all of its sectors. Metro City's positions, having said that, do reflect support for modifications to the governance structure. We do not believe that the Metropolitan Council is a perfect entity. If you were to look at the organization's legislative policies, you would see that many of them speak to the need for the Metropolitan Council to stay within its statutory lines of authority, for it to work highly collaboratively with local officials, to provide guidance, but not to stray outside of its line and lane. Metro City's positions on governance, we believe, support practical changes, common sense changes that would improve the council without creating a structure laden with risks for local officials that could result in lowering public trust. Metro City's encourages you to consider the significant significant benefits, for example, in reforming the council's governance structure by adding staggered terms and improvements to the nominating committee process. We believe that these modifications would address the issues and criticism of the council without the significant shortcomings that we believe this bill represents. Thank you, Madam
Chair. Thank you, Ms. Nellman. Mr. Kershaw. Welcome.
Welcome.
What is your name for the committee and the record?
My name is, Madam Chair, members, my name is Sean Kershaw. I'm the Executive Director of the Citizens League. Or as many of you know, we were the originator not only of the idea of the Metropolitan Council, but of an elected Metropolitan Council when we first proposed it. And I think it's also one of the Blue Ribbon panels that we think has worked to bring these ideas forward. We do share many of the concerns about governance that we've all talked about, not only today, but in the previous testimony. And we think in the work we did with the committee that we brought together, that as Representative Hornstein said, involved a wide variety of opinions and a really, really fantastic conversation about not what is just best for the region, but what we think is politically plausible. We did talk specifically about some of the ideas in this bill, and raised concerns that we think it would interfere with the ability of the Metropolitan Council to address the regional mission that it has, as well as address the political practicality questions that Representative Hornstein spoke of in terms of what could actually be implemented to address the governance issues we share. I think many of the points that we've made in the report were addressed by myself earlier, by Mr. Representative Hornstein, and by Patty Nauman. So I just want to express our shared interest in the concerns here, but our specific concerns about these proposals.
Representative Ibrahim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a question quick for Mr. Kershaw, and I apologize because I didn't go back and read that report. I ran out of time. I meant to. But when you proposed an elected council, was it elected straight from the public, or were you talking about having current elected officials on the body?
Thanks for the, Madam Chair, Representative, thanks for the clarification. And this was in the report that we did 50 years ago. It was elected by the public itself, not elected officials. So it set up a system of districts, and that was ultimately not approved by the legislature at the time.
Representative, follow-up?
Mr. Kershaw, I apologize for not reading it. I meant to look up, and it is 50 years ago. But I was just wondering, what do you think some of the problems would be to have current elected members sitting on this council?
Mr. Kershaw.
Double duty.
Again, I will modify my comments by saying that we were more in favor of the ideas that we proposed rather than we didn't go into lengthy in the report, which is 150 pages of really great reading, go into. I think we shared the same concerns. that it is a difficult job. I mean, elected officials often hold a job or a part-time job in addition to their first elected role. This is adding another role on top of that. There are potential conflicts in the authority in terms of being a regulated body and then on the other end being overseen by that regulated body. So I think what we talked about as a committee were the same practical concerns of the time limitation, the perceived concerns about holding both interests, and then the difficulty of just making sure that this body, the Metropolitan Council, which is different than other regional entities in that it has these major operating functions, should be governed differently than similar or organizations in other parts of the country that don't share that same operating responsibility. Pardon me.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to kind of finish up the conversation in terms of this compatibility and the conflict of interest. Having served on a city council for a major metropolitan suburb, and the comments that Ms. Newman made in terms of the Met Council really is more than just an MPO. I mean, it does much more than that. So our interaction with the Met Council was on a highly regular basis. And if this was before us, I would just be loath to take on that additional role just due to the perception of the conflict. And I don't think I just speak for me, but others would be faced with that same dilemma of whether to even to consider themselves to apply for that nomination. I think it's just wrought with so many concerns that why as a politician you would want to subject yourself to that. Has that been kind of thought through in terms of the practical applications or implications to this?
So, did you want to, was that Mr. Kershaw you wanted an answer from?
Perhaps it's
Ms. Nauman.
Yeah, I'm sorry, yeah.
And I wonder if you could maybe just address the fact that I think most of the other MPOs are COGS, right? Councils of Governance. And they do use local elected officials, if I'm not mistaken.
Madam Chair and Representative Carlson, Metro Cities, when it undertook its task force to answer that question first, tried to look at other regional entities across the country. There are COG models that largely serve from a transportation function, was my recollection. But the Metropolitan Council, as I pointed out, is far more than an MPO or funder or provider of transportation and transit. So it is singular in terms of its functions across the country. There isn't another entity quite like it. Representative Carlson's questions on the incompatibility were discussed by Metro City officials in the task force that the organization conducted on the issue of governance and from which our current policies emerged. And the issues that we looked at with incompatibility, and I have had conversations with nonpartisan staff and with attorneys on the issue, there are several court cases that have weighed in on the issue of incompatibility with respect to holding dual offices in which, for example, a person is both serving in a regulatory fashion and a regulated fashion. That would be the Metropolitan Council, whether we like it or not, does have some regulatory functions. The courts have also weighed in on the incompatibility issues associated with being a funder and being funded by entities. Pardon me, probably not very articulate here. City officials in our task force were very focused on the issue of incompatibility when Metro City studied this issue. It was a key concern. It was really what drove the organization to reject the model of having local officials on the Metropolitan Council.
Right. I see on the list Doug Anderson and Tim Gladhill. Are they still here? You've had a long afternoon, too. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Doug Anderson. I'm a former mayor of Dayton, Minnesota, 20 years on the city council, retired somewhat successfully. I also served on the board of League of Minnesota Cities, North Metro Mayors, Regional Council Mayors. So I got to be active and involved. Today I'm here as the citizen rep for District A, which encompasses Districts 1 and 2 of the Met Council, so Dayton, Greenfield, some of the satellite smaller cities to us like Champlin and Maple Grove and Brooklyn Park and so on. So. I've been on the tab for 1 year. I've sat on the bylaws committee, the executive committee now, and I've just got a few observations about the tab. It's you know, 34-member board, which I thought would have been unwieldy, but it's got a great diversity of geography, emphasis, experience, opinion. The board comes together in ways that I didn't think would necessarily happen. I sat through my first two-year solicitation in the last couple months. We dispersed $200 million, roughly, for worthy projects, but sadly, many of them were left behind because there just aren't enough dollars to go around. I think what I found is the members strike a great balance between the needs of their home region, their agency, the mode they represent, and also the needs of the region as a whole. So I think there's a huge regional perspective that you just don't see typically out of elected officials alone. So why keep it? I think it's, in my eyes, it's a model of transparency, integrity, accountability. It's time tested over the last four decades. And the TAB really does a deep dive into methodology for scoring these applications fairly. I think, you know, having my experience as an elected official, you know, we mayors work full-time jobs and kind of have another full-time job as mayor. It's really not practical for the city and county officials to take on the complexity of these issues and give it the time needed to really do that deep dive into, you know, what is fair. There's a lot that goes into those solicitations. Good projects come in and are scored, very fairly and openly. I think it's just a highly functional and cooperative board and filled with people with common sense and relevant experience. The TAB members, I think, are very accessible to the people in our districts. I certainly get calls from my cities regularly. And, we work with them and the other agencies to find ways to make things better, to get roads built, transit built, bike paths built, things that our region needs to get people around more effectively. It's really valuable work. It needs to be done deliberately, and it needs to be done well. And TAB works. It's highly functional. To me, it's a great example of Minnesotans getting together to do what's best for us, and it's great public service. I'm proud to be part of it, and I'm excited for the work they've done. I don't see a reason to change it.
So, Mr. Anderson, if I could ask, how many hours would you say per month? Are you involved in TAB work? And how many of the 34 members are actually currently serving in elected positions versus some other, have had other exposure public office?
Eight citizen reps, okay. Like me. I think there are, I'm not sure, I think there's seven county officials. I guess I don't know the numbers right off the top of my head. I don't remember those. I do spend, I would say, 10 to 20 hours a month on a TAB between the meetings. There's certainly other things that I could do extra as well. I'm on the executive committee, which not everyone is, and I've been on the bylaws committee, which has taken a little extra time. But also, members do spend a lot of time really digging into the numbers on projects and asking really good questions about the scoring methodology, and the meetings are. You certainly bring perspectives that we don't all think of when we're looking through those packets and talking to our cities, and it becomes a little ubiquitous in your life sometimes, so it's hard to put a time frame
sure.
on.
Yeah, exactly. All right, Representative Joachim, I have a question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, the question is to Mr. Anderson. Just a quick clarification: former mayor but current citizen member of the TAB.
I'm a citizen rep. Yes.
Thank you. And then follow-up. I'm sure you could probably balance and imagine maybe being mayor and on TAB, but could you imagine or maybe tell me what you would think of if you were mayor and trying to function on TAB? Because TAB is different. It just deals with transportation, and we keep saying that, and that's why it's an MPO that looks more like the COGS in other cities. But could you imagine dealing with wastewater, sewer, and all the other entities that the Met Council deals with on top of being a mayor in TAB and maybe having a
Mr. Anderson.
Well, if I didn't have to have a job and make a house payment, maybe. But no, I think it's you're serving too many masters and not able to give enough time. It's not really a dirty little secret, but the city councils love to blame the Met Council for things they don't like. They love to blame the legislature for things they don't like. But when the buses don't come and the toilets flush back at you, you kind of want them there. So you want people that can do the job. And
thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Gladhill, welcome to committee. Please give us your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to be here. My name is Tim Gladhill, and I am the Community Development Director for the City of Ramsey in my daily role. And through that role, I get the pleasure to serve on the American Planning Association Minnesota Chapter Board, currently as their president. Our two legislative platforms, both Ramsey and APA, closely mirror that of Metro Cities. But my comments here today are more reflective of APA Minnesota, which is a professional organization of some 750 city planners, community planners across the state that are very much impacted, at least for the metro area communities, by any sort of legislation that changes the Metropolitan Council. I do want to note that we do support some change. So we think champions like this and committees like this that can look to four ways that can create a more accountable and effective Metropolitan Council. And I'm focused more on the Land Planning Act at this point, too, when we talk about APA Minnesota. So again, very similar to the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities, Metro Cities, as well as Citizens League and North Metro Mayors Association, all have some similar views on this topic. We do support the four-year staggered terms. We think that is something that we can all get behind and create some continuity between administrations. And we also support accountability in the terms of the nomination process itself. Some things that we very much support that would go towards more effective planning. And being handed out right now is a copy of a more detailed position statement that our board put together over the last days that reflects our legislative platform over a number of issues. So we do support some change. I won't go into detail. Much of that was already supported by Metro Cities, and we don't necessarily object to appointing elected officials, but I do want to mirror the fact that it is a large time commitment for our elected officials to serve in their role as city council members and then try to be in the Metropolitan Council, not only in terms of time commitment, but potential time overlap. So it would be difficult for our council members on the edge of the metropolitan area to be able to get into a meeting that might overlap with the city council meeting. And so I'll wrap up very quickly here that APA Minnesota just went through a fairly robust strategic planning session. And we've been working on this slogan that talks about One Minnesota that focuses more, less on the divide, but more on uniting all of our communities here in the state of Minnesota. And it's in that spirit of compromise that we offer up these policy positions. And there's probably room for even some further negotiations moving forward if this is to move forward, whether that's a mix of existing elected officials or maybe it's a mix of that plus appointed. So we have a balance that is fairly representative. I see I'm getting the time card already, so I will stand for questions at this time.
Any questions, members of Mr. Gladhill? Any further discussion on the bill? Thank you, Mr. Gladhill. Did you have a question of...
No, I have a discussion on the bill.
Okay, very good. Thank you, sir, for being here. Okay, discussion on the bill, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to vote against this for a couple of reasons. Number one, you know, we agree that there needs to be some governance reform. I don't think there's a question on that. But I want to remind the committee that, you know, the Met Council, even with some of its concerns, it's received awards for its wastewater treatment system, national awards. It's run efficiently and it's run well. It's recently received a national award for the transit system, consistently among the leaders in fare box recovery among peer transit systems. So while there are problems with the agency, I think we also have to recognize its accomplishments. And so we're treating it as if it were so different from any other public entity, public agency that we fund through the legislature and that is accountable to us as a legislature. And I think that going to this fairly extreme, bill in terms of having legislative approval of certain projects, I mean, now we're going down a road where, you know, do we want to approve the Stillwater Bridge, for example, or any mega project? A light rail project is a big project. I concede that. But we have big road projects and other infrastructure projects. And so I think that's problematic. And in terms of, the whole governance piece, let's try to get something that's pragmatic that we can get through and agree on. And so I think we're treating this agency a little bit differently because perhaps some disagree with its mission. And I don't think that's right. And absolutely it needs some improvement. But it's not that different from other agencies that we have in state government. And so I think we're just going to a little bit of a extreme in terms of how we're approaching this. And Representative Albright, I think that while I agree with some of the critiques of your bill, I do think it has some potential. Certainly if we didn't have, if we had proportional representation, for example, some of the more populous counties were proportionally represented in your governance structure, we might have some openings there in terms of being able to work with it. But I think that former Mayor Anderson, or I should say Mayor Anderson, I think once a mayor, always a mayor, really raised some valid points about elected officials serving on this. But again, it's not out of the realm of possibility in terms of reform, but we can't move forward with that because you have all this other stuff now in the bill. It's not just a straight-up clean governance bill. So for those reasons, Madam Chair and members, I would encourage a no vote.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would echo a lot of Frank's statements. I know it's been a long day. We've all been in this room for a little bit. I've been in this room since 9 a.m., so feel sorry for me, right? But I really want you to think about what's all in this bill. We've spent a lot of time here now discussing just the Met Council regional governance, but there's a lot of other things in this bill. There's the farebox recovery that's 60% is way beyond any of our peer regions or peer states. Nowhere else in the country or even the world, for that matter, gets 60%. It's a laudable goal, though. We have issues in there now of legislative approval of a budget. We have eliminating the tab, which the mayor spoke so eloquently about how it's working. So don't forget we're eliminating the tab in this as well. And, of course, the regional governance and Met Council, but more importantly, too, is, and we talked about it before, and I'll just keep saying it, for those of you that agree with states' rights and you hate the feds telling you how to do something, 10 times more the state tells city councils to. And this bill strips away the ability not only for a city council to spend money on building, but on studying and on planning any light rail line. Why light rail and not BRT or anything else? Well, it's pretty plain why. But I want you to think about what you're doing to local control when you vote for this bill. I also want you to think with the regional governance structure. Ms. Nauman talked about this, and it made me really think. We talk about the perception of conflict and losing public trust. We saw that with Minnesota Sports Facility Authority on just a little sweet issue. Okay? Imagine issues like that coming up every single day with Met Council if you put elected members on there that are not only elected to one body having to represent one group that they've sworn to elect and are getting paid to do, but they're now being paid by another body to do a different job, and those will come into conflict every day because Met Council does more than transit. So you talk about the perception of the conflict, and you may not care if the Met Council has a bad reputation, but I care if my city and county officials get a bad reputation because of that perception of conflict. So think about the breadth and depth of this bill beyond the Met Council, beyond the trains, beyond the farebox recovery. There's a lot of perceptions in here and a lot of damage that can be done to our local governments, our counties, the folks that are closer to the people than we are. So I know I'm not going to change any minds here. Everybody's decided. They're checked out. They're on their phones. But just think about it. Thanks.
Representative Mason, some brief questions or comments?
Both. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm just going to focus on the sections 1 and 2 where where you're taking away local control. Again, city councils, and I'm assuming the regional rail authority, these are people that are meeting constantly. We are a part-time legislature. And that to me, I don't see how this part is going to work. But then the other thing is to actually take away authority for them to spend any money on studies or project development. I mean, that to me is just, as I said, appalling. That's what the job of a city council member is, to plan for the future of your city, of your area, and for for the legislature to take away that authority for the local control, I think it's just appalling. And so, again, the question is, when you've got people, entities that are working month after month on projects, and we're only here for a few months a year, why would you want to give the more authority to the legislature than to the people that are actually spending a huge amount of time on these projects?
Representative, would you like to answer? I mean, I'll
give you my viewpoint, and I'm sure others may weigh in, Representative Mason, but I think it not only goes to the rationale that you elicit with the amount of time that local municipalities work on projects, but in the grand scheme of things, those projects have to be paid by someone. And whether that be shared by the local municipality, the federal government, and the legislature that we are all a part of. But I think it's incumbent upon us to say that, wait a minute, before you get the cart before the horse, maybe we should understand if we are in agreement in terms of where that funding is going to come from. And so work is one thing, but paying for that work is quite another, and the work can sometimes infer that the money is going to be there. And so what we're suggesting is that before the work starts, we want to confirm that the monetary commitment is there to begin with.
I just want to follow up. Do you not think that some of these projects that you seem to be objecting to that have been in the works for decades, that people didn't try to get all of that put together?
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair and Representative Mason, whether a project is deemed meritorious or not, the functionality is whether or not the ongoing commitment to operational expenses has been committed to, as well as the CapEx. There is a difference between the capital expenditure and the operational expenditure. In most cases, when we talk about a project, whether it be in a bonding bill or a transportation bill, we talk about the CapEx. That's the downstroke in terms of getting the project moving. But what we oftentimes do not recognize is the ongoing expenditures that are incumbent upon either this body or the local municipalities to make sure that that project continues to work as it was expected. And in most cases, it's been my opinion, those expenditures continue to rise. And that just obligates both the municipalities, the counties, and the state for an ongoing expenditure that maybe they would have thought otherwise on if it had been included in the consideration for the capital expenditure.
All right, Representative Bernardi. I see Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bernardi made a point of saying she wanted to have the last say, so I'll be brief. I mean, we've seen these bills before. Obviously, we didn't like them then, and I think a lot of us, I should just speak for myself, still don't like them now. And there's, for a variety of reasons, it's just an explosion of government in terms of the makeup of the board. How the commissioners are weighed in terms of not weighed by population, which is especially unfair to some of the more populated areas. And then, of course, my biggest concern is the conflict of interest and how that matches up with the definition of compatibility. So, and that whole convoluted approach of how that would have to work out. My nature is to try to want to fix things, and having looked at this, it would just it would have been an endless list of amendments. So I just can't support this.
And Representative Bernardi, the last word.
Yeah, Madam Chair. Unless your side wants it, I'm just speaking for our side. I just want to first of all say that I think the Representative Albright, looks like you've done a lot of work on this, and I appreciate you making the effort at doing this. I wish we could have collectively come up with something that we think that would actually get passed by the governor. So I do want to thank you for that. But I'm not going to be able to support it because I don't think we're there yet. I think you can understand. We've kind of let you know a lot about that. But what I do want to say is I believe the Met Council, and we don't talk about this a lot, plays a really important role for not only our region but for our state. And we think of the space that it covers, but it really affects people's lives and their everyday life, where they can live, where they, how they can move about, and we're going to be getting almost another million people here in the state of Minnesota, and we need to keep a strong economically and opportunities for people. And I just want to make sure we have a solution that really builds on the strength of where we are with the Met Council and where we can go with the Met Council. And things that really need, I think, to be looked closely at this one and to try to fix it the best we can is, you know, the expansion of government, conflicts of interest, taking away local control, and really I think the unrealistic time commitment that I think this would put on people who would actually serve in this role that you're proposing. Because what I'm concerned with,
that's been a comment we've heard.
Okay,
no,
but what I'm concerned about, you're going to, when our testifiers talk today, there's going to be so much responsibility for one person, and I see it, you're going to reduce your pool of people who can actually do the positions. So you might have newly graduated students that are really young, might have retirees, and all these really rich people. Wanted to share that with you and hope that we can eventually work together and get a bill that will get passed. Thank you.
There be any other comments on the bill itself?
Well, Madam Chair, I'd like a roll call, please.
Representative Bernardi. Okay, roll call has been requested. I'll renew my motion that House File 1866, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections. All those in favor? Well, we'll go for the roll call. So,
Chair Rumbeck.
Aye.
Vice Chair Kosnick.
Aye.
Representative Bernardi.
No.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Barr R.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
No.
Representative Hertas.
Aye.
Representative Hornstein.
No.
Representative Cagle.
No.
Representative Mason.
No.
Representative McDonald. Representative New.
Aye.
Representative Petersburg.
Aye.
Representative West. Representative Whalen.
Aye.
Representative Joachim.
No. Vote of 9-6 members, the motion does prevail, and the bill will move on to government operations. Thank you, Representative Albright. And now we'll move on to a very short bill. Very brief re-referral at this point on 828.
Yes. Yep. Madam Chair, I think you have the instructions in front of you in terms of the re-referral for House File 828.
Yes, members, we're going to move House File 828 as amended, bring it back to committee, and then recommend that it be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections. Is there any discussion on that bill? Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wondering what the intent is to moving both these bills forward. I know they're already been scheduled. I just saw it show up for government operations on Tuesday. So lucky me, I get to hear them again. I'm just wondering why both are moving forward.
We, I guess, at this point are not certain what's going to happen in the Senate. We don't want to have bills happen that we can't match up with, et cetera. So it's really making it smooth at the end.
So vehicle bills, I'm hearing. Okay,
yes, probably. Okay. Any other conversation? All right. All those in favor of moving House File 828 as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay.
No.
The motion does prevail, and H28 as amended is referred to the Committee on Government Operations, and we thank you, Representative Albright.
Members, thank you.
Thank you to the committee. It's been long afternoon, and I appreciate your patience, and have a great weekend. We are adjourned.